I'll call the meeting of the Energy Finance and Policy Division to order. We do have a quorum present. Have a very long agenda today, members. I appreciate your willingness to accommodate that by meeting early. Hopefully we can wrap up by the end of our regular time at 4:15. As I said, we do have a quorum. The first order of business would be the approval of the minutes from the March 16th meeting. I would entertain a motion to that effect. Representative Falk, thank you. Motion for the approval of the minutes is before us. Any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor of their approval, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Members, what we're going to do today, particularly for members of the audience, have a number of bills all relating to the federal stimulus money that's coming through the Department of Commerce. And as you recall, we heard very early on House File 680, Representative Kalin's bill, dealing with the structure of those funds. What my intention today is to hear all of the proposals that would like to be included in that bill. We will lay them over, and next Monday we will take up the bill to mark it up in the way that we typically do a finance bill. This is not our division finance bill, but it is a finance bill that in many ways is quite comparable to that. So we will be hearing these bills today. They will all be laid over until Monday when we mark up the bill. To begin today, what we have asked is that the Office of Energy Security give us a brief overview of where we stand, what we know currently about the federal stimulus money coming to the department, and for that purpose we have Director Vaughn and Mr. DeFebra. And Director Gahn, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
If you want to begin your overview, we'd appreciate it.
I would. Again, for the record, I'm Bill Gahn, the Director of the Office of Energy Security. And
does music always play when you do that?
Mr. Chairman, I thought it was only in my head. I didn't realize it was. it could be heard by others. Mr. Chair, I am Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Commerce, and I'll let Mr. DeFebra identify himself for the record here.
Mr. DeFebra, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Jeremy DeFebra with the Office of Energy Security.
Mr. Chair, if it pleases the committee, we responded to a request from Mr. Pomeroy to provide what our preliminary thoughts were that we had come up with on how to how to spend the money that we're getting from the federal stimulus. Keep in mind, this is a plan that we came up with before we had gotten guidance from the Department of Energy, the strings, the rules, the points that they wanted to emphasize as part of their instructions to us. We did not have the benefit of that when we prepared the plan that your staff is handing out. But we, based on what we knew and our best guess, that we put that together. And since that plan was put together. We have gotten the guidance on the low-income weatherization piece, and again, I'll defer to Mr. DeFebri in a moment or so to give you the details on the dollars, et cetera. But we've gotten the guidance on the low-income weatherization piece, which is the bulk of the money, and the public or the state energy program, which together are 90-95% of the dollars involved. We have not gotten the guidance on the block grant, which will be available to localities, cities, counties, et cetera. And we have not gotten the guidance on the appliance program. So those are two of the smaller pieces. But based on what we knew before we got the guidance and based on our experience in this area, we put together an outline of the plan. And, you know, it's something for people to take shots at. I know it's not going to please everybody. It may not please anybody. Try to please ourselves first, I suppose. But the thinking behind the plan was we're trying to balance three competing objectives. One, the goal of the stimulus itself, which is to put people back to work, or to retain jobs for people whose jobs are at risk. Thing two is to save as much energy as we can per dollar of stimulus funds. And part three is to do it as quickly as possible. The stimulus itself really runs its course over 18 to 24 months. And so in looking at putting together an outline of a plan, we tried to take stuff off the shelf, utilize existing programs and approaches to so we wouldn't have to go and invent the wheel to, and create more barriers to getting the dollars out the door. So we put together a plan that tried to balance creating jobs, saving energy, doing it all efficiently, and doing it all quickly without creating fraud and waste and all the other attendant problems that go along with spending lots of money in a very short period of time. So that's really the thinking behind our plan. We try to balance it so there's a public buildings piece, there's a residential energy piece, renewable energy piece, an education training component. We think that's very important in terms of putting people back to work, retraining the workforce, and getting the skills out there. We wanted to have, and we think this is very important, to have a piece where there are lots of entrepreneurs, there are lots of inventors out there with really good ideas. There are lots of technologies that are just on the cusp of commercialization, where if they got just a little bit of encouragement, they could go and commercialize products, start businesses, and create jobs that will be around not just in the next 18 months, but the new industries of tomorrow. So we wanted to have something where people could compete for amounts of money in that area to really launch new companies, new industries, new ideas. And the industrial and commercial piece. Now, that's not quite so emphasized in what was our earlier plan, but as perhaps Mr. DeFebri will elaborate, part of the guidance, which was somewhat unexpected to us, were goals for how much energy you were saving per dollar of stimulus funds. And I'm sure you've heard, and maybe ad nauseum from us, really what we found the biggest bang for the buck in energy efficiency is in the commercial and industrial sector. So perhaps if we were to redo this plan over again, we would emphasize more the commercial and industrial sector. We mentioned the St. Paul Port Authority's idea by name. We really would like to see something available for the whole state. So if somebody has something up in Bemidji or down in Marshall or some other place in the state where there's a good energy retrofit project. And what I have in mind are plants that just shut down or plants that are right on the edge of being competitive within their industries, and all they need is a little bit of oomph on the energy efficiency side to make them competitive and retain those jobs, or put people back to work where they had to shut down because they weren't competitive. We really want to have that available because we think on the jobs per dollar spent, that might be the biggest bang for our buck. So kind of with that overview, that was our thinking on when we put our plan together, and maybe we've had a little bit of a chance to rethink with the guidance, perhaps more commercial, industrial, and we are aware of not just our little piece, but the stimulus bill as a whole. There are monies for grants for window installation, I think it's $1,500. There are grants, tax credits for wind and solar and small-scale renewables. And so we've tried to craft our program to leverage those dollars. So we're not, we can put a little bit of our money and then leverage other monies, whether they're available through the stimulus or federal tax incentives or utilities conservation improvement programs. with the idea being that there are already funding sources available for some of these ideas, and we'd like to see what we can do to contribute a little bit to leverage it. But we want to emphasize areas where there aren't pools of money available, and we might be the only game in town. So that might be ways in which we would tweak this plan if we sat down with a clean sheet of paper today. But that was my broad overview, and I wanted to turn it over to Mr. DeFebri to give you fill in some of the details.
Thank you, Director Vaughn. Mr. DeFebri.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I thought perhaps it would be best if we just initially went through what the numbers are that we know that we're dealing with, and the guidance we've received and allocations that have been published are for weatherization assistance program and for the state energy program, both of which are formula grants that we have received for 25 to 30 years through USDOE. The weatherization assistance allocation under the stimulus is $131,938,000 and change. In context, we typically have gotten between $9 million and $11 million in an annual allocation for weatherization assistance from the Fed. So it's a very, very significant ramp up. One change to the federal guidance and the underlying federal law that is in the stimulus bill is we had been held to what functionally had been approximately a $3,000 average this year per household on spending federal funds. That was changed in the ARRA to a average of $6,500 per household. So given if we do find cost-effective measures in a household that are more tend to add additional costs, we have the capacity now to go to deeper levels of savings in those households. It remains to be seen, I think, as we look at some of our data from previous years on what had been cost-effective measures that had to be passed up in other houses, whether we are going to hit a $6,500 average or whether it will be something slightly lower than that. At $6,500, we would be serving approximately 7,000 or 17,000 households with the stimulus funds. That's assuming that of the 131,000 or 131 million, approximately 11 million of it goes to administrative costs and about 10 million goes to training and technical assistance costs, and those are very rough preliminary numbers. And so about 111 million of it would actually go into homes. On the state energy program side, the allocation is $54,172,000. Again, in context, our current allocation for this year under the state energy program is $716,000. So initially it seemed to us a staggering sum, but as the list that Mr. Pomeroy put together suggests, there's if not a staggering number of ideas on how to spend it, there's certainly a more than adequate supply of those ideas. So as Mr. Glahn said, we are looking at both what the stimulus bill says, what the federal guidance says, and what we believe Minnesota's priority should be. And the guidance has provided us with more weight towards energy efficiency than we thought, actually, even though it's an energy program, DOE would put in. They look for a minimum cost effectiveness on spending of funds that approximates to about a 10-year simple payback. And that is a minimum on all the expenditures. So if we are doing activities that weight towards training or future development, that those dollars are not going to show the immediate energy return, we do need to find other activities that do have the more significant energy return. We also believe that it's important that we do better than just the minimum, that both to deliver value with these dollars and to position ourselves for competitive grant possibilities and future activities that may come out of other federal initiatives, it's important for us to perform as something better than the minimum. The other two areas where we will be receiving a formula allocation that we have not gotten any guidance or specific allocation from the Fed are in the energy efficiency and conservation block grant. I think we have a fairly reasonable estimate of $13.9 million for Minnesota's share based on population. Of that, we are required to subgrant 60% to small cities and counties. The remainder we can use for activities that are generally allowable under the FCC plan or under the Energy Efficiency and Conservation Block Grant authorizing statute. The final piece that we do not have numbers on is the Smart Appliance or Energy Star Appliance rebate program, which is funded at the federal level at $300 million, and on a population basis, we anticipate a little over $5 million for Minnesota. That is likely going to require a 50-50 match of local funds. I think that likely leads us to look at participating with a number of the utility appliance rebate programs that we already have. Those are the basics.
Thank you, Mr. Diffie. Are there questions for either of the testifiers? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. DeFebre, you mentioned in breaking out the different allocations of money under the Weatherization Assistance Program kind of struck me, but I think you already have that program in place and working now, and yet you made reference to the fact that it was going to cost, you set an estimate of $11 million for admin costs. What extra are you going to have to do to make this program available that you aren't already doing now, except to add extra money to the to your bottom line?
Mr. DeFebre.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, I should note that of those dollars, approximately 75% of them would be for administrative costs at the local agencies that deliver the program. So we are talking about, at our level, approximately over the 18-month period, utilizing $3 million of the stimulus for administration. We are anticipating hiring 12 additional monitors for the program. We're very concerned with this level of ramp up in the program. Serving that many additional households is going to require many new energy auditors in the field, many new contractors and construction crews at agencies that run their own crews that are going to be doing work under the program. And we have a minimum requirement that we inspect 5% of those homes for quality of workmanship and compliance with federal regulations. That Commissioner Wilson has expressed his own concerns that this needs to be done right, that with a lot of new workers in the field that we need to inspect more than the minimum number of homes, and he has directed us to plan to inspect 10% of the homes that are weatherized. That leads us to almost 1,700 homes. To physically do that, we are going to add 10 technical monitors. That's the bulk of the additional cost that we are looking at for administration. We are also going to add two additional financial monitors to monitor the financial activity and uses of funds at the 32 agencies that deliver the program on a local level. And there are many ancillary costs related to that. We are likely going to have some of those monitors located outside of St. Paul. They're going to be significant travel costs related to them traveling the state to visit homes in every community that serves, and a number of other things. That's where the additional administrative costs largely lie.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. DeFebre, my understanding is that the stimulus package is one-time money. And once 24 months is up, now you have taken and you put all these people in place. What's your solution to the next 24 months after that as to how to sustain the amount of money that you've got that you don't have, or that you won't have?
Mr. DeFebre.
named as the chair, Representative Anderson. It is maximum 24 months money. We are anticipating hiring temporary unclassified employees for those positions. If what we hear from Washington is true, it's the administration has committed to maintaining similar funding levels for weatherization beyond that period. But we are planning for hires that are only for a maximum 24-month period until we hear otherwise and see cash on the table.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. DePibri, that's good as far as the temporary, but now that you've added 1,700 new homes on the list as far as getting the stimulus money, is there a plan to get 1,700 homes off in the 24 months after the 24, so there won't be that same amount of money that's going to be needed? You say it's going to be continued. I'm just concerned about once you add more people to the system, that are we going to have the extra money? You might have to lay off all those 10 or 12 additional monitors or the extra monitoring that you do with the extra people, but the extra people that you bring on to the weatherization assistance program, I'm just concerned about the fact that you have another hole of 24 months where we come up with the extra money to further assist those that we've brought onto the program, and that's my concern.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I just want to clarify that it's actually 17,000, correct? 17,000 homes we hope to additional homes. And these are one-time things. So you go into homes, you put in insulation, you look at ceiling, windows, and doors, and high-efficiency furnaces if that's needed, and other measures if they're cost-effective and available under the cap. And then it's 10 years. You can't come back into that home for 10 years. 15 years. You can't come back in that particular residence for 15 years. So, but I think I hear what you're saying, 17,000 homes, and then perhaps we will have to scale back the program and do fewer homes the next year. And maybe we'll go back to the, we've been doing about 4,000 a year under the current program. I don't know if we'll, depending on funding availability, have to scale all the way back to that. But we're trying to be cognizant of that issue that you brought up, but at the same time not making commitments to folks that and not raising expectations that they're going to have employment, that these are permanent positions, and our you know, to the extent we have a hope, the hope is that we'll have the 24-month period to do a lot of good, and that the economy will be turning around, and that these folks will have other opportunities available to them, or we'll have a higher, more permanent level of funding where we can bring people on as permanent employees.
Representative Gonser.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Either one of the testifiers, when you send people down to check on somebody's furnace, where are these people going to come from? Are they not displacing?
Representative Gonser, could you use the mic, please?
Okay. Where are these people going to come from? Are they going to displace local contractors? Are they going to be trained in the cities and everybody come out of the cities, charge mileage to come down to fix that furnace? How are we going to do this? And I look at the CAF agencies that take care of weatherization money. I think they've been begging for more money. I don't think they'll charge you any more.
Professor Guan.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we anticipate that, trying to answer your question a little out of order, that we're going to need more auditors. They're not displacing people who are already doing this. We actually need to supplement the core of people already doing this. So we're looking at bringing people out of the trade, the engineering background, who are capable of doing that audit work, is going down looking in the furnace to see if it needs to be replaced, or taking the infrared camera around to see where there's leaks that need to be filled. So we've been working. We have a program at the Dunwoody Institute we've told you about before. We've been working with MNSCU on how we can roll this program out outside of the Twin Cities and the greater Minnesota, because we have with 32 CAF agencies cover every square inch of the state. They're all going to need more auditors. We're not going to have people in cars driving 5 hours up to the far northwest corner. But we're going to look at training people around the state, have programs for training around the state, and we actually need to add to the ranks of these folks and train them in those skills to get them out there and doing the work.
Representative Gouser.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Assistant Commissioner, can you tell me how long a training this is going to be? And is the training going to take what percentage of the 24 months we have to get this done to be trained? And to what extent are they going to be trained?
Mr. Chair, Representative
Mr. Guan,
if I remember correctly, it's a two-week program. Okay, I'll let Mr. DeFebre answer.
Mr. DeFebre,
I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, Representative Gonser. Currently, for energy auditors, there is a one-week program that covers the basics of energy auditing, and then there is a competency test at the end of that. We are anticipating adding at least 3 to 5 days to that, particularly to cover more thoroughly HVAC systems. We anticipate that the agencies, when they hire auditors, will go through what is likely a 3-4 month mentoring period with their existing auditors before they do turn them loose.
Mr. Chairman, one last question.
Representative Gonser.
Could you please give me and anybody else in the committee that like it a list of all these admin expenses and training expenses that you're incurring and how much they're going to be? Because I'd rather give money to people that need energy assistance than I would pay for administration and training.
Mr. Chair, Representative Governor, we'd be happy to do that for the
committee.
Members, as I pointed out at the beginning of the meeting, we do have a very aggressive agenda, and I think we need to move on at this point unless there's some really desperately compelling question for either Mr. DeFebre or Director Guan. Seeing none of those, gentlemen, thank you. Representative Kalin, if you want to give us sort of a brief reminder of your bill and its history since it left this committee a few weeks ago.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. We saw House File 680 in this committee, I think, about 4 or 5 weeks ago. We have since been, at that point, we were first referred to the Representative Clark's Housing and Public Health Committee. We came to this committee. We had a vigorous discussion in Chair Mahoney's Workforce Development Policy Committee, and then in Representative Rukavina's Higher Ed Finance Division of the Finance Committee. And then yesterday, Chair Atkins heard the bill in the Commerce and Labor Policy Committee. What you see before you is represents, even though it is actually thanks to a glitch in the revisor's office, technically the first engrossment, it is substantively the result of the input of many of those committees and many of the members here on this committee informally that were then formally integrated into amendments. Mr. Chair, again, the bill as we have it before us is a framework, does not have appropriations allocated to it as of yet. The three or four, I would actually say four main goals of the bill, just to reiterate and remind you, we're getting the weatherization funds out in the field as quickly as we can. I appreciate Representative Gunther's comments. We want to be helping people by putting them back to work, by saving energy, and providing needed service, the kind of win-win-win that weatherization services really represent. We want to maximize that opportunity and do it as quickly and timely as possible. That's Section 3 in the bill. Section 4 and 5 is the public building renovation component for local and state, or local and school projects, as well as state government buildings. I believe that this is also one of the fastest ways that we can put folks to work. We've probably heard the term shovel-ready more than we care to, that may be the new low-hanging fruit, Mr. Chair. In this case, the low-hanging fruits are actually tool-ready and wrench-ready. We don't need shovels for energy efficiency projects. The third component that's been something that I've been working on with folks, I think we're going to hear from next on Representative Olin's bill, and that is looking to see how we can do energy projects that actually result in more than just the folks-wearing tool belts and the energy savings, but how we can try to get a gain on our manufacturing, commercial, industrial sector. And as you know, members, Minnesota really is the Silicon Valley of windows, with Anderson and Marvin Windows and Cardinal Glass and 3M making the films, etc. I think the working to figure out how we can make window replacement a priority for Minnesota will have benefits that meet the goals of the federal bill as well. And then the fourth key that we've had some discussion just now about is the training need. I just remind you that if we're going to be doing the weatherization program, performing the insulation and ceiling that is really critical to making that program work, we need to have qualified, well-trained home energy auditors. We need to have certified energy managers and other advanced energy engineers in our public buildings helping to make wise decisions. Energy efficiency is not so much a science as it is an art. And it has to be grounded in good energy management, but also requires some creative thinking and analytical assessment. That ongoing work is going to be critical to positioning Minnesota not only for the times of the stimulus, but to Representative Anderson's good question, I think we can make a lot of progress for the long-term competitive positioning of the state in terms of our clean energy policy. Mr. Chair, I'd like to point out, look to two sections that I think have changed substantially since we heard the bill, and that I hope that we can retain as we move the bill forward ultimately. Section 2 lays out the guidance for the department and the goals that that I would like to see, and I hope this committee endorses, for the federal recovery dollars. And it's really subdivision 2 there, enumerated in lines 2.28 and beyond. First and foremost, job retention and creation. Second, energy gains through either efficiency, energy savings, or renewable energy production. Third would be the leveraging of other resources. Fourth is the timeliness. Fifth is the long-term sustainability of the benefits. We don't want to spend money and have it just make one cycle, but really to have long-term benefits. The sixth is geographic distribution across the state. And seventh is making sure that we're providing access not only geographically, but also to all socioeconomic parts of the state, so that we're providing pathways out of poverty and replacing unemployment checks with paychecks in a long-term sustainable way. And then I'd like to point you, Mr. Chair and members, to Section 8, which is the accountability and transparency reporting. We learned yesterday, Mr. Chair, you were at the, I believe it's the Commission on Fiscal Planning and Policy is the technical name.
Yes.
From Commissioner Hansen about the reporting requirements on a quarterly basis to recovery.gov. I think we'll have to do some work to align the dates of reporting that we have here, but we want to not only satisfy President Obama and Vice President Biden's requirement for accountability and transparency and results. I think it's important that we in the state be able to answer to our constituents that we have indeed achieved our goals and that we are delivering on the rhetoric that is turning into real results. And I will point to item 8 on that list, the compliance with prevailing wage veterans and disadvantaged business enterprise requirements. That points to the access and outreach, but I do want to just point out that the prevailing wage issue was not yet resolved when we were here last time. We have since learned that Section 1606 of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act requires that every dime of federal recovery dollars be covered by prevailing wage, and it's the federal prevailing wage. It is a game changer when it comes to residential work in this state, but it is a requirement of the federal act, and we will make sure that it is there. One principle that I had from the beginning is that we should not be handing out Minnesota Care applications At the same time, we hand out job applications. Prevailing wage, we'll make sure that that does not happen, Mr. Chair. So, but that's, I think, the review of the bill again, and a little bit of an update. I'm not going to answer questions, but I'm really hoping that we spend most of our time hearing from the other projects.
Yes, thank you, Representative Kalin and members. Keeping in mind that we are going to be marking up this bill on Monday, if you have any questions that need to be asked now, please let us know. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Kalin has talked about accountability and transparency reporting. Do you have a fiscal note for this bill? And if so, how is it going to be broken out according to the accountability and transparency reporting section on page 5, where you've got the administration, education, employment, all those people being a part of this? I guess the first question is, do you have a fiscal note that we can see?
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Anderson. Not as of yet, and I think that we'll have to ask the department to the information that we've heard from them verbally, the Office of Energy Security, I think the question that Representative Gunther asked as well about administration of the project goes to that point. All the elements in Section 8 overlap entirely with the recovery.gov federal reporting requirements. And one question that came up yesterday in the Fiscal Policy and Planning Commission meeting that Commissioner Hansen and the Speaker both had questions about was the federal bill provided resources to the GAO, the Federal Government Accountability Office, for auditing. We are not, I think the question is still up in the air about whether we're going to have to allocate the resources for the further state and local auditing, or whether it is part of the formula from which we are given. I'm going to assume that it is our responsibility to make sure that that happens ourselves until we have further guidance. Again, I think we're going to have to ask for something in writing from Office of Energy Security, whether a formal fiscal note or other means of answering that question.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Kalin. So, according to this accountability and Section 8, mm-hmm. do you know what the guidelines are for the reporting back to the Office of Energy Security as far as the needs for the individual departments indicated here in this is it based on a percentage, or is it based on a dollar amount, or what?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson.
Representative Kalin.
The department's names there are named as such because they are named in the bill as collaborators or consulting agencies. For instance, Department of Education, obviously we want them to be a part of the work on the public school retrofit and renovation. And so all of this will be Office of Energy Security dollars. And as you know, when there are contracts or cost sharing, that it's the agency with the dollars that can dictate that in the original agreement with other agencies.
And Mr. Chair, one last question. In the line 5.24, it says compliance with prevailing wage. Is that state or is that federal prevailing wage?
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, it is federal prevailing wage because it is the requirement of the federal bill.
Thank you, Representative Kalin. Seeing no further questions, we will move on to House File 958. Representative Olin. My members, let me remind any of you who weren't paying attention or any of you who came in late that it is the Chair's intention to lay all of these bills that we're hearing today over for Council markup on Monday. Representative Olin, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of this committee. I'll make my comments brief, explaining, and I'll turn it over to the two industry experts I have with me. This file number 958 came around because It was a concern of mine that when we deal with federal stimulus money that I knew was going to come into play, that the area of windows sometimes hasn't been included in some of these energy type programs, like weatherization, et cetera, and I wanted to make sure that it was included because for two factors. One, it should be included because windows can do quite a good job for efficiency. And two, when you deal with industries, I have two major industries sitting beside me, one of them from my district, Marvin Windows, and the other, Anderson Windows, very much affected by what's going on with this economy, and any breaks we can, and any assistance we can give them is in our best interest. I think the bill is pretty self-explanatory. It's twofold. It deals with windows in public buildings, which could cover schools and all sorts of other buildings. That brings in a whole array of possibilities because schools in general, some of the rural schools especially, are not very efficient when you look at their windows. And the second part adds in residential energy efficiency programs, energy efficient windows by definition, so it isn't left out of the definition. That's basically what the bill does. And I will turn it over to the two experts for any further comments.
Thank you, Representative. Mr. Chairman and Committee, my name is Susan Rader. I'm with Anderson Windows. And joining me today is Steve Turek with Marvin Windows. And our industry, as Representative Olin alluded to, has been dramatically impacted by the downturn. The housing downturn is in its third year. So it has been long felt, and the recent economic crisis has impacted us very greatly. So we're very encouraged by the federal stimulus package and the spirit with which the energy efficiency message was written into it on all levels. I think we are lucky within the state of Minnesota. We have two very large employers who excel at this. Anderson and Marvin have both been around for over 100 years in the state and employed people in the state that long. And we see a real benefit to energy efficiency in all forms. And Steve's going to talk a little bit more about that in a moment. For Anderson, we know that with the downturn has come temporary layoffs for us in the hundreds of layoffs. And that's been very hard for our people and our company. And we very much look forward to the day when we can bring them all back to work. I think it was interesting Mr. DeFried mentioned a number of 17,000 homes that they would be targeting in the state to work on weatherization, and I'll use that number as an example when I speak about jobs for Anderson. If those 17,000 homes replaced their windows in a year, in this year, with some incentives from the federal government, that would extrapolate, if you averaged a home at 16 windows per home, that would extrapolate to 270,000 windows that would need to be built. If Anderson was required to build 270,000 windows in 1 year, we could hire 220 new employees. And our employees certainly make prevailing wage. The average job pays approximately $50,000 for a production employee with benefits. So those are good jobs. We'd add 220 jobs to the payroll this year to build those windows. And in addition, those windows would need to be installed. And we have the capacity to do that, as do a lot of great contractors in the state. To install the windows in those 17,000 homes, you need an additional, and this is assuming three-person crews, takes a week to install those windows, take out the old ones, put in the new ones. That would be 1,056 jobs in the state, additional jobs. And those numbers are very real and very exciting to us. And so clearly there's a lot of factors there. In the state of Minnesota, there's 1.4 million homes that were built prior to 1976, which is when the state and federal folks put in some really critical guidelines on energy efficiency. In addition, there's another 1.7 million built since 1990. Clearly, these homes are, you know, 17, 20, 50, 100 years old in some cases, and there's even if a percentage of those homes that needed windows had been replaced, clearly our businesses would benefit, as would our competitors, and we would really, really appreciate the opportunity to do that. I will turn it over to Steve. He has some additional thoughts.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Steve Turek, and I represent Marvin Windows. As an executive at Marvin, I'd like to address the job creation issue from a slightly different perspective, and that is talk about job retention. Every company has to deal with the kind of economic contraction and hardship that we're undergoing right now in their own way. The Marvin family and the Marvin companies have chosen to keep everyone working. We have not laid a single soul off since this contraction hit. We are choosing to lower our profits and sacrifice those in favor of keeping people working and keeping communities vital. But as this recession drags on, every morning I wake up thinking, how are we going to do this? And it gets harder and harder. So any opportunity manufacture more of our good products and have them installed so that state buildings and residents in this state can conserve energy expenditures is a win-win that we're highly in favor of. I'd just like to briefly address a couple of things that I think sometimes get overlooked in the general rubric of energy efficiency. It's widely accepted that buildings account for approximately one half of all the greenhouse gas emissions in this country and one half of the energy expenditures annually. The Efficient Windows Collaborative website, and I'm quoting statistics that are not Marvin's. These are independently generated statistics by governmental agencies and NGOs, so they're widely accepted, and there's a lot of research supporting them. In climates with significant heating seasons, windows have represented a major source of unwanted heat loss, discomfort, and condensation. With new technology, it's now possible to have lower heat loss, less air leakage, and warmer window surfaces that improve comfort and minimize condensation. And that new technology is employed at Anderson, it's employed at Marvin. These are the energy-efficient products, the new generation of energy-efficient products that we're talking about. The Federal Energy Management Program of the Department of Energy says that a typical home loses 25% of its heat through windows. In older homes with poor windows, it's even greater than this. And the Department of Energy Energy Star program a week ago released its new criteria for 2010. They calculate that those new standards will save the country in excess of 9 trillion BTUs of energy. We've run some calculations for a home in Minneapolis, a 3,000 square foot home in Minneapolis, and we think using any number of different glazing solutions to satisfy the new Energy Star criteria will save in source energy costs anywhere from 37% to 43% in Minnesota. We're talking about real long-term energy payback and savings. The final thing that I would like to say is I think that I don't want you to understand Susan and I saying that windows are the solution to energy efficiency. We are not saying that. What we are saying is they are part of an incredible solution to energy efficiency. The front line of energy efficiency and energy savings is the envelope of the building. That's the front line in that war to conserve energy. And insulating a building but not putting energy efficient windows in it is just creating a piece of Swiss cheese. What's going to happen is you're creating tunnels where all that energy will rush out the windows that you're saving in the walls. Similarly, going into an older home and clocking it up a little bit and putting a brand new furnace in it means that you're wasting energy at 95% efficiency. So I just want to encourage you, as you think about solving this problem that we have about creating and retaining jobs and also saving energy costs and moving us toward a lower carbon economy, that you need to think in a holistic, integrated way, because insulation and windows and doors all have to be energy efficient so that that energy efficient furnace is really delivering what you are buying it for. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the testifiers? Seeing none, thank you very much. We appreciate
you
coming.
Thank you.
Next on the agenda, Representative Olin, House File 1052.
House File 1052 with Shannon's coming down here. It's a little different variation. It's a smaller request. It's only a $300,000 request. And it's based on working with Dan Jewell on some projects up in Kitson County in the city of Kennedy, which will add employees, and it was also do a lot to make an old school that now has become part of the city property because the school district disowned the school by a bond referendum that closed down the Kennedy School and put it all in Hallock, which is one of the never-ending things that goes on in rural Minnesota. It'll make this school a youth building, a useful building, and it'll be able to be used by Dan Jewell's company and several others, and I'll let Shannon Mortensen, who's the city clerk and all sorts of other titles in the county of Kitson, explain in more detail.
Ms. Mortensen, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for allowing me to speak to you today on behalf of the city of Kennedy. As Representative Olin said, I am Shannon Mortensen. I'm the city clerk treasurer of the city of Kennedy. The city of Kennedy is pursuing funds for a green business incubator that focuses on green energy development. The Go Green Business Center will be a model for the use of green energy and host green energy businesses. The incubator will take us all into the future of green energy use. The center will start out by housing some of the most respected people in the field of new and emerging alternative energies. It will provide an environment for entrepreneurs to share research, developments, ideas, and contacts. It will be a location where citizens, communities, and students can see, touch, and feel green energy and learn firsthand how to adapt that knowledge to their own environment. We do have three green business tenants that will come on board once the energy conversion is completed. The first tenant will be Next Generation Power Systems, Inc., which is a company that's owned by Dan Jewell. If you are not at all familiar with Dan, he is a highly respected businessman who pioneered wind energy. And today he does travel all over the country consulting on wind energy development. The company Next Gen sells wind turbines, solar panels, geothermal, and backup systems to farms and residences. This equipment will be used in the green energy conversion, and then it will provide a showcase in which people can educate themselves on alternative energy sources. The second tenant will be Todco, and this company is owned by Todd Houston. He's a master electrician from Kennedy. But the unique thing about Todd is he holds an EPRI transmission tech license. So this license allows him to do the calibration of highly sensitive metering systems. There are only a handful of these individuals that hold this license in the states of Minnesota and North Dakota. So this licensure will be invaluable for him as he installs the next-gen systems. So Todd Cole will install and maintain the next-gen systems that have sold. The third tenant will be in the center next spring, and that will be Jewell Wind, which is a publicly held company started by Dan Jewell. Jewell Wind is constructing a commercial wind farm south of Kennedy. The wind farm will be 19 wind turbines with a construction cost of $200 million. So during the construction and after, there will be service and maintenance technicians employed. So these businesses will create 6 to 8 jobs by the end of this year, 2009, and there should be 16 to 20 jobs created by the end of next year, 2010. So you have, in less than 24 months, have created jobs with an estimated payroll of almost $1 million. And these are new jobs that will be created. Now, the City of Kennedy is pursuing other green businesses at this time. We are confident that they will locate at the Go Green Business Center next year. Dan Jewell would also like to create an education center where people from all walks of life can come and learn about alternative energy. Collaborations will take place between the center and institutions of higher learning to further the development and education of green energy. Dan's vision and overall goal is to educate society to further the use of alternative energy. So the $3,000 the City of Kennedy is requesting would pay for the conversion for the entire building to geothermal, wind, and solar energy. Dan Jewell is providing the materials at cost, which contributes to the low price tag. And this conversion would then be a model for other buildings and create the fill place needed to enhance the use of green energy. Now these tenants, they don't only talk the talk, but they walk the walk. They do not want to be in a fuel hog building, and they want to end everyone's dependence on fossil fuels. And this building that they're in is a fuel hog. Right now, we are estimating it's going to take 30,000 gallons of fuel oil to heat for this season, and that is having the building at 55 degrees, which is the lowest the thermostat will go. So ending our dependence on fossil fuels is not only the goal of the tenants, it's a goal we all should have, and the Gold Green Business Center should help accelerate and achieve that goal. The city is pursuing other funding sources. A grant has been submitted to the Federal Economic Development Administration for $368,000. The application required administration and engineering costs to be included. The district representative, John O'Leary, came to Ken Eady. He reviewed the project. He toured the building. He was very impressed with the condition of the building. And so after his tour, he stated that he would recommend funding to his regional director. Well, last week we did receive notification that that this project merits further consideration, and there were some points that we needed to fulfill. And one of the points was we have to provide the 50-50 match. So it would be the City of Kennedy's hope that this project can be a joint collaboration with federal and state dollars. And these funds then would help move alternative energy development into the next decade and help end our dependence on fossil fuels. Now, we do have a great amount of community support for this project. In January, the city determined that we didn't have enough fuel oil to heat through the winter. So a call went out to the community for donations, and local farmers donated 5,000 gallons of fuel oil to help heat the building. And every one of them that came in my office to donate said, we want this building to be maintained so that we can hold businesses that our community needs in the future. So the community wants this, and the area needs this. So we are asking for your support of $300,000, but hopefully only $184,000, with the federal dollars, which would create a new economy in northern Minnesota that would benefit the entire state. I do understand the budget deficit, and I understand the challenges you face. But with this project, you will create jobs. You will increase the energy efficiency of a building, therefore cutting operating costs, and you will also increase the exposure of green energy to everyday citizens. So the money appropriated to this project will be an investment, not an expense. It's an investment that our country and our state desperately need at this time. So I want to thank you for considering this project, and I will answer any questions.
Thanks, Ms. Mortensen. Representative Phelan, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Mortensen, I want to thank you for your time going over the project with me a few weeks ago. I think you guys have done a very strong job of doing your homework and answering some questions that I had, and you make a very compelling case, especially having tenants interested already. I just want to share for the committee's benefit, knowing the work that the federal, the U.S. EDA does, and John O'Leary's office, that I think it's something like 95% that passed the pre-application process actually, and that are asked for the detail that I think that you've been asked to provide. 95% of those projects receive their US EDA grant. And so I just thought it'd be helpful. You know, in some cases we're gonna be making a little bit of a step forward, wanting to make sure that other leverage funds happen, and it sounds like we have a very strong signal from the US EDA that this project is worthy of some more consideration by this committee. So I just wanted to set that out and thank you.
Well, thank you for your testimony. This will be laid over.
And thank you for your time.
I want to make one change on the agenda here to make help accommodate members. Representative Cornish, would you like to present your bill? Okay. the members, I believe in your packets we've got a collection of different projects which aren't exactly in bill form. Representative Cornish, do you have an identifier for your bill?
Mr. Chair, members, inside your packets, hopefully there will be a color. Well, here, yeah, some around now. Be a folder here that you can walk through once I introduce you to the testifier.
Members, it's the DE-050 draft that we're working off of. Representative Cornish, please start walking us through it.
Mr. Chair and members, what I have here is a proposal, DE-050, as possibly, depending on your wishes, to be amended onto the House File 680 of Representative Kalin's bill. What this is a request for the funds from the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009 for a prototype project. There's a dairy farm in my district that's over 1,200 cattle in this dairy farm. I've been down to visit it. A number of employees, and the problem the dairy farmer has in providing electricity or energy to it, the electric bills are running from $6,000 to $10,000 a month. And what we have here is a proposal to provide a solar energy project or a prototype solar energy project that would cut these substantial down, and it would be a fund to operate, build this system at the Star Farm that could possibly be a model for others to look at in the future. And I'd like to introduce my testifier, Mr. Preuss, who would walk you through the packet and tell you more about the project.
Mr. Preuss, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chris Preuss. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. If you'd like to start, I have page one, and you can see there's a satellite view of the farm. It's a large dairy farm, 1,200 cows, and the owner is Mark Starr, has traveled all over the United States and the world to try to find a way to cut his energy costs. He's very efficient. He's changed all the light bulbs. He's changed milking machines. He's gone through pretty much every easy process that could be done. And what he's trying to do now is to determine how to move forward with some kind of savings for his exorbitant energy bills. Besides those $6,000 and $10,000 a month, he runs two generators through the summer to mist and keep fans running on the cows. The cows produce more milk when you do that. He's looked at alternate forms of energy. He's looked at biomass, he's looked at wind, neither of which are the type of system where you can put it up and forget about it. His goal is not to add another process that takes time and money as well as employees. They run on such thin margins in the dairy business that he couldn't afford to do that, which is why the solar makes the most sense. The proposal is to put a 350 kilowatt solar system on trackers near the barns where he needs the power. The project cost, if you refer to page two, you'll see an outline of the cost. The total dollar amount, and by the way, these are aggressive prices that we've had all of the people throwing in discounts, because the goal is to do a prototype farm in Minnesota so that we could hopefully do more of these over the next several years. The total project amount is $2,102,200. The farmer is going to put in 10% of his own money, and then the final grant request is $1,891,980. However, there's a twist on this. Because there are grants, there's a tax grant for 30%. There are also some other grants that are we will probably get, very strong possibility. What we'd like to do is to try to get the total amount in grant form and then repay back the tax incentive that we get, up to, which will be 30%, as well as the other grants that are available. So that would reduce, we believe this would reduce the final amount down significantly, where the state would have $736,000 approximately after repayment. That would be the total amount. The reason we are asking this, it's a little bit different approach, is because the way the grants are written, you can't have access to the funds until after the project is complete. And that's what we need to do. We're trying to figure out a way to do this project because we believe it's going to allow us to do more projects like this in the state of Minnesota for other energy use farmers and ag processing. So that is the goal there. The process that we use is one that's been being used by a sister company of ours in France. They've done 200 farms like this. They have 100 more in the queue. There's a system in place where the manufacturer puts the trackers and the panels, all of it is almost pre-assembled before it lands on site. It's a very simple process. This is what we're trying to do for this particular farm. We have a very good team. We have two engineers that have over 25 years experience with local power companies in the renewable sector. We'll also bring in our engineers from the manufacturer of the panels and from France, where the farms are being done there. We feel that this is part of the future. These farmers are going to need to do something. All of them that have these high energy bills are looking at alternatives. And we'd like to offer an alternative that is low maintenance and lasts up to 40 years. So that's our target. It would also be nice, I think, to have Minnesota be in the forefront helping their farmers with new technology and going green.
Thank you for your comments, Mr. Kreuss. Any questions from members? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cornish, your testifier. If this grant was to be given and you are able to get it, would this be a kind of like a standard available to all farmers across the state of Minnesota? Would this be kind of a beginning for solar energy available for all?
Thank you. Yes, it would be. We'd like to try to do this as a prototype where the other farmers will come in. This particular dairy is a showcase dairy, and Mark Starr gives tours, and he's very good at educating. The goal being we get other farmers in to see how this process works and how simple it really is. And I think with the renewables advantages that are coming out of the Obama administration, the fact that the solar panel price is dropping rapidly, this is definitely a technology. I think the time is right that these farmers are going to want to take a hard look at, and I think a lot of them are going to go for it.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Cornish, there is a grant right now from the federal government right now for solar of about 30%. That's about, you know, and you mentioned paying back money back to the state in regards to that. So are other, do you know of other farms that are in line for wanting to get the same type of loan or grant to go forward with?
I have contacted many dairy farmers and ag processing plants around Minnesota, and they are all very interested in this process. I believe with this, I think that once I get this started, that they're going to line up to explore how they can do it as well. It's a wonderful way to go, because unlike some of the other technologies, there's virtually no maintenance once the system's in place. And it lasts for 40 years at 80% capacity, so there's very little degradation in the quality of the panel.
Further questions for Representative Cornish? Representative Jackson.
I noticed that one of the uses is for heating water for sterilization of the milking components, laundry, and animal cleansing, and I'm wondering if there's any thought to a combination use of photovoltaic and solar thermal, because we know that solar thermal is really efficient for heating water.
It very much is so. I've met with the Sunny Skies, I think it is, in Starbucks, Minnesota, who makes a solar panel, thermal solar panel, and it's the Cadillac. It's a real good one. And we've looked at that. That is a possibility. For the first step of this, the farmer wants to focus on the electricity. There's going to be enough electricity generated that he can probably heat quite a bit of his water, because the local co-op will only take back 40 kW on an ongoing basis of power. So the excess power during the day that he'll generate, we'll use that to make heat, to heat the water. So, but it is, once we see the average of that, then we'll add the thermal. And we're going to buy them from Starbucks. They make a very high quality product.
Any no further discussion?
Sure, I'd just like to thank you for fitting this into your schedule. And just so you don't think this is a huge company with no known names, this is a fourth generation family farm from the area with 18 employees and runs 24 hours a day with a lot of family members. So not a huge corporation from another state. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Member.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for hearing this request today, committee members. I'm going to be brief with my comments here. I have with me Mr. Dan Evans, and he'll talk more specific to the project that we're presenting to you, but I'll just hopefully I'll have a handout on this. So the top says solar product manufacturing infrastructure overview, and this is a joint venture effort of the Leech Lake Tribal Government and the Rural Renewable Energy Alliance, and the intent in perhaps Representative Jackson's comments were quite appropriate as a lead in to me here, because this is about solar thermal panels production up on the Leech Lake Indian Reservation. So, Mr. Evans.
Mr. Evans, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Purcell. I'm here to talk about a project that we want
to... Mr. Evans, we do need to have you identify yourself for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Dan Evans, with Special Projects Consultant with the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe.
Thank you. Please proceed.
We're proposing to do a joint venture with an existing nonprofit company that's been doing solar technologies for a number of years. As John mentioned there, as Representative Purcell mentioned, their Rural Renewable Energy Alliance. They've applied for a patent for a particular thermal solar panel that would be used as a solar furnace. In fact, that's the name of it, solar powered furnace, and they have several different models. We're looking at acquiring a license to market that to other Indian tribes in the upper Midwest, as well as commercialize it and transfer the technology to the Leech Lake Reservation. This is approximately 4,000 tribal members that live on the reservation, which is between Bemidji and Grand Rapids, Minnesota. It's about 1,000 square miles. We're looking at unemployment on the reservation that exceeds 38%. Underemployment exceeds 70%. Jobs is a primary consideration with the new administration, as well as green technology. What we need is some help in fixing up a building. The tribal government has contributed investing a building to this project. We need some help in helping to get it fixed up and renovated. We want to incorporate the solar technologies that we'll be producing at the manufacturing plant into this building, where it'll be LEED compliant. To give you an idea of the type of energy efficiency this building
will, when it's completed, it'll save over 10 tons of carbon emissions a year, just with the building that we want to house the manufacturing plant in. The products that they're going to produce, each product will reduce carbon emissions by approximately a third of a ton per year. So we're ready to go. As soon as the frost's out of the ground, we're ready. We have a building up there already identified. We just need a little help on the financing, which is going to leverage more money than what we're requesting, which is $500,000 for this project. The number of jobs that will be created will be fairly minimal at first. We're looking at 12 to 15 positions. But once business starts and the marketing gets ramped up, we're looking at that increasing significantly. We're looking at covering an upper Midwest territory that encompasses more than 40 tribes within a 4 to 5 state area. We've talked about being anything that we do with the stimulus package. If this works out, we would certainly be transparent and be accountable to whatever the strings are that came with this from Washington. That would not be a problem at all. I guess that's kind of a summary of the project. I'll just leave it there for questions.
Mr. Chair, with that, would entertain any questions?
Mr. Evans, the one question I have is, what is the status of the actual manufacturing processes that you anticipate implementing?
Well, once the building is fixed up, we'll be ready to go.
You have all of the product development and all of the production facility equipment that you need in order to do this at this time?
This is going to be a joint venture between the tribal government and REAL. REAL brings to the project the management. They're going to license the product to the new LLC will be created. Be 50% owned by the tribal government and 50% owned by REAL, the nonprofit. REAL contributes the technology, the training, and some of the management that we'll need during the first 12 to 24 months. That includes, they already have an existing operation. They just needed to scale up their capacity. So that's how the whole conversation took place, is they needed to increase their marketing capacity, or their manufacturing capacity, and we needed jobs up there. So what the Leech Lake government is bringing to this is access to a labor force, and they would like to fix a building up according to the specs that they need for the manufacturing facility.
Okay, thank you. Further questions for Mr. Evans or Representative Purcell? Seeing none, gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just as we're going to be moving to the next bills, I just want to apologize. I'm going to have to duck out. I have a bill up at 2:45 in Representative Junkie's committee, and it's first on the agenda, and I'll be back as soon as I can. I just wanted to apologize.
We're looking for Representative Junkie to duck in also, since he's on our agenda.
Perhaps Representative Hoppe, Mr. Chair, would like to take over House File 680, it sounds like. Mr. Chair, can I deputize him for the 15 minutes that I'm out?
I have a feeling it was half.
We should try to let you get down to the end. Representative Dill, if you want to give us an overview of House File 1730, I think now would be the time.
Thank you.
concern about the delay. Representative Dill, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Hilty, and this is my very first appearance before this committee. Thank you very much for the opportunity to come before you. Are we ready to proceed on the bill? Is the bill, and I understand the bill is going to be laid over for possible consideration.
That's correct.
All right, thank you very much. The bill before you, members, is a bill, believe it or not, Senator Bach and I are authoring about green energy. I know you may find that hard to believe, but it is true, and Representative Kalin's reaction is what I expected it to be. The thing about this is involves wood, and something you know that we have is very abundant and renewable. But the difference in this project is that, first off, the company that owns the vast majority of the investment in this company now is Cliffs Natural Resources, and Cliffs Natural Resources, for those of you who are familiar with the mining industry, have a significant presence in the iron mining industry in northern Minnesota. The project before us is an interesting project because they have patented and make a value-added engineered product that looks like it's a biscuit that goes in a barbecue, except that's char rather than wood in a barbecue. And the project will cost between $18 and $20 million to construct. And the bill is specifically tied to a loan that has already been made at the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Board for $3.9 million, a low interest loan at our formulary rate, which is at about 3% of the $20 million. And this project will be obviously very green, support faltering logging industries that are faltering, and our infrastructure for all segments of the logging industry is now being sold off, and companies are going out of business because of the huge downturn in that industry. It displaces dollar for dollar money that normally goes to pay for coal to come into this state to generate electricity, as an example, or to run industrial-type furnaces. It's using a patented, as I said, engineered technology, and it goes directly to improved emissions and the requirements of the renewable energy standard. This bill, and Mr. Biasetti is going to talk very briefly about some of these things, but it dramatically, if you have the handout on this, it dramatically makes reductions in CO2, SO2, and one thing I think you'll like is mercury, particulate matter, acid gas, and NOx, nitrogen oxide. My last thought about this, Mr. Chair, before we go to Mr. Biasetti, is that I think this is the most key element of the entire bill, other than its a wonderful investment in these northern communities, is that this project and bill enables new technology that's patented, that's protected by a Minnesota company to, one, use Minnesota's renewable natural resources, which is our wood supply, and do it in a value-added manner, not just chipping it up and putting it, and I'm not diminishing the value of doing chipping and putting it in the facilities to make electricity, but this is this next level up where you have value added. It does so very sustainably because of the resource. And the third thing is, and I want you to all hear this, that I'm saying it. It preserves our environment for future generations.
Representative Kalin. And Representative Canoe.
Thank you, Representative Stills.
So I'd like, if you would please indulge us a moment for Mr. Biasetti to tell you about the environmental consequences of this bill.
Certainly, Mr. Biasetti. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Rico Biasetti, General Manager of Alternate Fuels for Cliffs Natural Resources and also the CEO for Renewal Fuels. Thanks for the opportunity to present to the committee today. Renewal Fuel LLC is a subsidiary of Cliffs Natural Resources, and it's a next-generation manufacturer of renewable energy for industrial and institutional applications. As you'll see on the document we provided you, use of Renewal Fuel's engineered products in a place of coal-fired with coal, results in substantial environmental benefits. Third-party emission testing using U.S. EPA Technology Verification Organization, Southern Research Institute, and Natural Resource Institute have documented that the use of renewable fuel products in place of coal substantially reduces credible emissions of carbon dioxide, sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxide, particulate matter, and mercury. Use of renewable fuel products in place of coal also results in 100% reduction in certifiable CO2 emissions. It's on a life cycle basis. And more specifically, it resulted in a 95% reduction in sulfur dioxide, approximately 56% reduction in mercury, as well as substantial reductions in particulates, acid gases, and nitrous oxide. But in addition to that, we've also have patented several products that go a little bit step further. They're additives within our fuel. And what we can do at that point is we further demonstrated reducing emissions of coal when coal fired with coal. These products are capable of reducing SO2 emissions by 95%, NOx emissions by 30%, and chlorine by as much as 100%. The other one that we haven't listed here is still in the under review by the patent authority, is that we also have an additive that can reduce mercury, in addition to what Senator Dill mentioned earlier. We've also developed a state-of-the-art drying system that uses biomass as fuel and relies on thermal oxidation. Flue gas recirculation and heat recovery, resulting in one of the most energy-efficient and lowest-emitting drying systems available. The reason why that's important is that every other dryer either uses propane or natural gas. We use the biomass and we recirculate the flue gas in order to create efficiency from that. We also have the 14-to-1 energy balance, meaning that our engineered products produce 14 times more energy than what we use to produce that product. The extraordinary energy balance of renewable fuels products sets us apart from many other biofuel producers. And as power providers and heavy industry seek compliance options under the new RPS ruling and future carbon mandate, renewable fuels engineered products will provide environmentally friendly, cost-competitive alternative fossil fuels. What we do is we can actually engineer a fuel for a specific customer. We don't produce a single product that's just mass produced. If we have a customer that's looking for a specific product based upon the boiler type or their manufacturing, we can actually engineer that to their specs. In the same respect, if they have an issue with a particular emissions problem, we can add an additive to address specifically that emissions problem so they can come back into compliance. That's the biggest difference between us and the others. Renewable fuel plans to market our products to power producers, industrial users, energy users, and we ourselves, in our minds, are looking at using it in our own facilities, in our own iron ore facilities. Our products are well positioned to allow existing industrial facilities to green their energy portfolio in the replacement of coal. We also plan to establish a 150,000-ton production facility in northeast Minnesota in the next year, and we're currently conducting due diligence on finalizing two site option agreements. We anticipate an investment to be as large as $20 million to get this facility fully operational. Renewable Fuel will be working to submit our EAW and permitting documents to MPCA within the next 90 days. We plan to have Minnesota facility operational by the second quarter of 2010, in either case. Renewable Fuel will provide good-paying local jobs, create demand for states' abundant natural resources, and displace expenditures of out-of-state fossil fuels. Since Representative Dill stated, it's a one-for-one with coal. We have the same BTU value, the same component, and actually handles much like coal. Let me see, I lost my place there. Right. Renewable Fuel anticipates that local investment feedstocks result in annual retention of more than $10 million in the local economy. For each 150,000-ton plant, we'll employ 25 people directly, and we anticipate that the indirect jobs will be about 100 people per 150,000-ton facility, mostly in the logging industry, the management, and some of the other logistical components. Renewable Fuel is well positioned to produce the highest energy, lowest emitting biofuels commercially available in the U.S., and we do believe that the use of the federal dollars to support this project will forge the goals of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, growing high-quality, green-collar jobs right here in Minnesota. And we look forward to investing in Minnesota and sincerely hope that the committee will seriously consider using recovery and reinvestment funds to support this exciting and innovative project.
Thank you. Mr. Biasetti, do you have a facility that's producing this product right now?
Yes, we do. We have a facility.
Where is that located?
We have a facility in Battle Creek, Michigan. And that was a R&D facility that we then expanded to a full commercial facility.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Biasetti, I've got two quick questions. At least I think they're quick. Do you burn things in the, or do you plan to burn things other than wood, the briquettes?
Well, yes. Well, we utilize to make a briquette.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we can actually utilize a number of products. We use wood fiber.
Okay.
We use agricultural products. And then based upon the RPS and upon the state, we can also use waste paper.
Okay. One more quick question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you. Mr. Biasetti, without asking you to give away any trade secrets or anything like that, if you're spending up to $20 million, what kind of a horizon, time horizon, or are we looking at for your payback?
Yes, the payback, well, it depends on a couple of items. You know, really, we have the $20 million, but the other component is the cost of our feedstock. Our feedstock is our single largest cost to the facility, and it depends on what we can negotiate for our feedstock agreement.
Well, Mr. Chair?
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you. Just, and again, I'm not looking for any deep dark secrets. I'm just curious if this is a 10-year time horizon before the plant starts to become profitable, or 50 years, or just an idea.
Just under 10 years.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Doe, I hope this means you'll start voting for some of my greenhouse gas bills. But the question, it does relate to greenhouse gas reduction, because I see right here you've got 100% reduction, which is if you're just talking about the burning. But I'm curious about how much fuel you use to move this stuff around. I mean, that's one of my biggest concerns with biofuels, is how much we spend moving it from. I mean, I know you're located near where our forests are, which is great. We shouldn't be carting it down to southeastern Minnesota, but I'm just curious how you bring that into your calculations of your fuel environmental impact.
We actually come in to take a look at our carbon footprint versus that of coal, and they stopped counting. I think we were at 70 to 1, and that was just for the mining of coal. Most of our resources, actually all of our resources, depend upon the locality of it, close to the plant, local farmers, local growers, and we're staying right within that community versus the coal, which is coming from, in many cases, up in Wyoming.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hill.
The other thing is a couple of the locations that are being considered are on the rail at the site where the plant would be constructed, knowing that it takes very likely the least amount of fossil fuel to move the biggest amount of, except for ships, on a rail. And so that is also a part that they have focused on in the actual location of the plant, is to have rail access as well as, of course, truck access. And then regarding this, gases, we all get to vote on a lot of gas bills around here, but I'll consider your greenhouse in the future.
For some.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gilt, is there a location for this at this time?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Gilt.
They have had a press conference a few months ago up in the Orr Cook region, and that is another item that goes directly, and Mr. Biasetti answered that in a way, is that they have strategically located that after doing a significant study of looking for the material they actually need so that they can draw from a very limited area to reduce trucking costs, to reduce a part of the emission bill within a 30-mile radius of the plant site. So that was strategically located as well. And actually, it's been quite complicated to get a major U.S. highway, the CN rail, and get the resource all in the same spot. Just so happened it's in my backyard. What a deal.
Seeing no further questions, thank you, Representative Bill.
Thank you.
Representative Junkie.
House File 1723.
Representative Johnson, welcome to the committee.
All right, members and Mr. Chair, I bring this bill to you with somewhat of an urgency, and as you've been, I believe, working down here, I want to join that conversation as we look forward to DOE, federal DOE money showing up at the Commerce Department here in Minnesota in the stimulus package, and to understand what those monies can be used for in a short order here in Minnesota. And one of the, I think most of us are thinking, and rightly so, that this is for window replacement and insulation and energy upgrades to our homes and businesses around the state. And rightly so, a lot of that money will be coming in for that. Clearly, when you read the federal guidelines, and we have had folks obviously looking into what exactly is included in the federal stimulus package, we want to make sure the Commerce Department is directed and understands that there are a lot of projects beyond those type of projects I just mentioned. And so in section one of this bill, if you go actually to the second page, you're going to see the gist. The first part of that is pretty much boilerplate that we're seeing in other bills come through, which I don't think anyone has a big argument with. Starting with C on 2.3, you see what we're bringing forth to direct commerce, that eligible projects include but are not limited projects that, number one, improve the energy efficiency of biofuel facilities. What does that mean? If a ethanol plant, which we're trying to improve their footprint, their carbon footprint, other things, if they're interested in a biomass gasification system or putting up a windmill to replace a natural gas system, etc., those projects clearly are eligible for those federal dollars, and something we certainly want to pursue in Minnesota to help make our plants even more efficient out there. Number two, displace fossil fuel energy inputs with energy derived from renewables. For example, anaerobic digestion is mentioned there. We're way behind in this state and this country on anaerobic digestion, utilizing our livestock farms out there in particular, but certainly municipal waste digestion too from our cities around. All those projects are eligible according to the language coming out of D.C., and we want to make sure the Commerce Department understands that and is taking applications for those that might want to do that. Produce biofuel or bioenergy. Example, we have our first ethanol plant in Minnesota doing a pilot project establishing an LG to biodiesel facility in conjunction with the ethanol plant. There will be a building connected to the ethanol production plant. They will use the carbon dioxide coming off that production to feed into the algae growing facility. They'll utilize the heat coming off that to heat the algae growing facility. And that biofuel facility will now be developing biodiesel from algae at that same site. That's the way we want to go with these plants. That would be a kind of project that would be eligible for planning dollars or pre-design dollars or other things from the Department of Commerce. And then, or of course, wood waste in northern Minnesota, wood waste electric plant up in your area, Mr. Chair, using wood waste. Those types of projects would be eligible. And then number four, install commercial scale solar photovoltaic, solar thermal, and wind energy. Again, all projects that are currently being developed in our state that maybe the Commerce Department would take those applications, maybe they'd look at them, maybe they'd award grants, but we want to make sure that they are directed by us as a legislature to definitely look at these and to accept some level of application from those projects also. So, members and Mr. Chair, I bring this to you for your consideration. I think you're putting together, if I'm not mistaken, a larger bill in a directive manner over the next couple of weeks here. And we wanted to have the discussion with you and make sure that we had an introduction and a seat at the table for some of these important areas, too, that are eligible for that money.
Thank you, Representative Cassie. Are there any questions for Representative Mack?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Was the motion to lay this over for possible inclusion?
That's correct, Representative
Mack. Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Junkie, I think I did sign on co-author in the bill here because I do think it's it's probably a wise thing to do to have. You know, we've heard several testimonies today and several bills come forward today with ideas that I think, you know, may have some merit and may need some work. We don't know how they fit in a whole time, you know, a whole framework of what we're, what we probably should try to accomplish here in the state. At least we have a system in place where the Department of Commerce has been doing some of this, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Junkety, we've worked on this in the past, so I do think it is a good idea that we do try to at least try to manage some of these ideas into a more of a general framework of what we're trying to do in the state.
The other thing I'd point out, Mr. Chair, the one difference you may see in this bill is in the first page there is a consultation with Commerce and the Commissioner of Agriculture, which is why I'm carrying it over. As you know, they do a lot of the biofuels. We do the ethanol funding and next-gen energy grants and other things over there. So we certainly want a consultation there on projects that are eligible with those two commissioners and departments also.
Anything further for Representative Junkety?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
And members.
Well, we're still not seeing Representative Eakin here somewhere. Apparently not. Representative Johnson, do you want to... take center stage. House File 1469, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. This really is a good bill, and I'm sure you look forward to hearing it presented. What this bill does is create a demonstration program called the Trillion BTU Energy Efficiency Improvement Program, and the effects of this program will be to reduce energy consumption by 1 trillion BTUs, yes, that's 1 trillion BTUs, in commercial and industrial facilities. And just for a frame of reference, a trillion BTUs would be the annual energy consumption currently of half the buildings in downtown St. Paul, so over a year. Half of the energy consumption. Now, the St. Paul Port Authority, which has a lot of expertise and experience in this area, would be the agency or the group implementing the program. And what's exciting about this program is the first in the nation to use energy conservation as an economic development tool. And briefly, here's the way it works. The businesses would voluntarily agree to energy audits paid for entirely from a utility conservation improvement program. Engineering studies would follow to provide a blueprint to specific improvements that would reduce a business's energy usage. Then the businesses in the program would pay about a quarter of the cost of these studies, and using a combination of federal stimulus and CIP funds would finance the installation of necessary improvements. Then, energy savings resulting from the improvements would repay program expenses. Members, this is quite a program, and it would occur within the XL service territory. With me to add whatever words of wisdom they wish to is Peter Klein from the Port Authority, as well as Lori Lauder.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is Lori Lauder. I am Director of Business and Intergovernmental Affairs for the St. Paul Port Authority. You have a handout, and I'm just going to be very brief. I thought I'd give you some high points about Port Authority and what we do as an economic development agency. We've been around for about 77 years. We have a key mission, we believe, to provide business growth in the commercial industrial sectors and to drive towards our business customers, providing job creation and retention. And we do that through a variety of means. As you can see, we have several areas, several key areas of economic development. We clean up brownfields, we provide business financing, we do energy conservation efforts, such as saving 475 jobs at the Rock Penn plant and so forth. We have decades of experience in business lending and loan servicing, And I think you can see on the sheet that we do a number of other things as well. River shipping, particularly bringing farmers' products to worldwide markets downriver and so forth. Mr. Chair, I would also mention that there are a variety of organizations that support this effort, support this new program, such as the St. Paul Area Chamber of Commerce, also the City of St. Paul, as well as Xcel Energy, the Center for Energy and Environment, and various other environmental groups. With that, I'd like to introduce Pete Klein, our Vice President of Finance, to provide some of the key highlights of this proposed new demonstration program. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Lauder. Mr. Klein, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I am Peter Klein, Vice President of Finance with the St. Paul Port Authority. And I'd like to go over some of the goals of the program, the background of how it was developed, how we see it working, and the expected results. And the goals of the program are fourfold. One is to improve the economic competitiveness of our existing businesses by reducing their energy costs and making them more able to retain and create jobs. We also want to expand the existing energy conservation industry to increase engineering expertise, to increase installation expertise, and thus a job creation strategy. We want to reduce the fossil fuels, the use of fossil fuels, and the related carbon emissions and pollutants that come with that, and to enhance the utility's goals of energy reduction through it from its customers. The background, the way this was derived, was our work with the Rock 10 recycling facility in St. Paul. We did receive funds from you a few years ago to look at renewable fuels for Rock 10. And in that process, what we found was that energy conservation is less costly than energy creation. And it really is an effective strategy for improving the competitiveness of our businesses. And at Rock 10, that facility was the high-cost producer of its product in the Rock 10 corporation. And through energy conservation and other efforts, it's become the low-cost producer. And the energy conservation efforts that have been implemented are, a lot of them are just simple bread and butter projects like lighting and insulation and heat traps and using excess hot water that was previously not utilized. What we found with Rock 10 is that the St. Paul controller would ask for funds, and then the New York controller would ask for funds from corporations. And projects with six-month paybacks would probably get funded. Projects with one-year paybacks might get funded, but anything over that probably were not going to get funded. And so what we were looking at doing is creating this pool of funds that would be available for businesses to invest in projects that maybe had a 1 to 5 year payback period. Definitely projects that should be invested in, but just have not been allocated the capital needed for that. The way the program will work then is basically a shared savings agreement with the company and the Port Authority, that the energy savings from the conservation projects would be utilized to pay back the loan to the company, and then the company would also retain some of those savings, reducing their expenses and increasing the bottom line. We believe that an interest rate will probably be charged on those funds, probably 4% or less, and the primary risk that we see to the program then would be if a company were to shut down. Another advantage to this program is that we are going to leverage conservation improvement program funds, and those funds would be utilized to pay for energy audits for a significant percentage of energy studies and engineering studies, and then to reimburse or rebate costs of actual projects, theoretically 25% at this point. So it is a job creation proposal, it is a job retention proposal, and it certainly is an energy conservation effort. And the support that we have, as Lori Lauder has stated, XL Energy, the Chamber's business has supported it, Environmental Group, CEE, and Fresh Energy, and Isaac Walton, others. We have people in the audience, but in interest of time, unless you want to ask some questions, they're in the audience for support. Ann Hunt of the City, Rick Evans of XL, Sheldon Fromm of CEE, Don Arnosti, and Labor is also in the audience that fully supports this program.
Mr. Klein, what is the overall cost you anticipate for this program?
The cost?
Yes.
Well, the name of the program was derived from, the Trillion BTU program was derived from looking at expected savings from energy investments, energy conservation investments. And we felt that $24 million of new funds would leverage $8 million of conservation improvement funds, and that would save $1 trillion, or 1 trillion BTU.
And Mr. Klein, the appropriations is a blank in this bill. Are Representative Johnson or Mr. Klein, are you asking for, are you looking for $24 million in this bill, or is there, would this leverage additional funding?
Mr. Chairman, the ultimate amount of $24 million, we think, as Pete mentioned, would generate a trillion BTU savings per year. However, we know there's certainly scarce resources. We think that an amount more in the range of $5 to $10 million would allow us to at least start this demonstration program, get some legs under it, show production, and seek additional funds as we move along.
And we also have funds at the Port Authority that we would look to also leverage into the program.
The description of the project and the program and the bill is to design, among other things, design, develop, and implement. Are we at the pre-design stage then? What kind of work has been done on this project? I mean, we're considering this, not as an economic development project, but rather as a stimulus project. The question would be, how soon and to what degree would it be capable of stimulating anything?
Thank you for that question. We've met with several businesses, many businesses, and in fact there was an article in the paper over the weekend, and I've received several calls from businesses that are interested in this program from that article. But there are businesses right now that XL has been working with extensively, that they have performed energy audits, and some of them have even gone through the engineering study to come up with a proposal of energy conservation. But the corporation is just not able to allocate funds at this point toward energy conservation. They simply have higher priority needs for those funds. But if they had those funds available through this program, they would immediately be able to implement their projects. And we feel quite strongly that if it was a $24 million program, that it would probably be able to be implemented over an 18-month period. But if it was something less than that, we felt very strongly that we could implement this in approximately a 12-month period. But projects would be implemented this summer.
Thank you. Representative Magnus.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you brought up some questions I was going to ask, but as I understand this, no. Let's just say we would put $5 million into the
up for availability. And as I understand from your testimony, then that these funds would be put into projects that would have a pretty quick payback.
Absolutely.
On this. And I think I also heard you say that $24-25 million would go, you know, a long way. But is there, Mr. Chairman, my question would be, is there some thought to doing this and putting it up in kind of a revolving loan type of situation? Let's say if you went with five now, and if you did have a 5-7 year payback, you would be able to put some money out if you set it up as a kind of revolving system like that. Have you given any thought to that? Does that make any sense, or am I completely off on my thinking here?
Mr. Klein?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the revolving loan concept is exactly what we are proposing, is that the businesses will pay these funds back. There will be a small interest rate charge. We think that there are projects out there, the projects that we have been discussing have a 2-year payback. And we think that within a 2 to 3 years payback, 2 to 3 years of investing in those funds will be available to other businesses to invest in like-kind projects.
Further questions? Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry to duck in towards the end of the conversation. But Ms. Lauder served on the Green Jobs Task Force, and actually the loan guarantee question that I know is part of this financing package has been one that we've been trying to tackle in the state. That because of restrictions on bonding, it's tougher for us to do it than other states. So I think Representative Magnus's question, there may be I'd like to see a way to continue to do the C&I revolving loan or ongoing investment, but I know that there may be some restriction to using federal funds and having them as part of a revolving loan fund. So I just want to raise this question because it's a question that's come up in my bill, the way it's structured, and so we'll just have to check with Office of Energy Security for a final question just on that piece of it. I want to see the way that we can leverage as much of these funds as we can and do it. Take a lesson that the financing model that you have helped put together and help it work in other areas as well.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kalin, thank you for that comment. We'd be happy to look at that, look at the federal requirements, and in fact, we do have a cash flow that Pete has done, so we can show the revolving nature, and if we need to look at some more of those details, we'd be happy to do that.
Thank you. Seeing nothing further, Representative Johnson, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Eakin. Representative Eakin, welcome to the committee. I understand you have an amendment, which
we do, Mr. Chair.
We are laying these bills over, but your case will have to move the bill before us. To be before us, Chair will move that House File 1408 be before the committee for consideration and for possible inclusion in a stimulus finance bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as you said, there is an amendment to delete all amendments, DE1.
I think Representative Eakin, we have superseded that with the DE2, which hopefully you're aware of.
I was aware that there may be a DE2 amendment, yes.
Representative Eakin, I will, the chair will move the adoption of the 1408 DE2 amendment to put the bill in the form that you wish to have it considered.
Okay.
Seeing no discussion, all those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative Eakin, to your bill as amended.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The intent of this bill is to use a portion, $1 million of the federal stimulus money to create a broad-based incentive for Minnesotans to purchase renewable projects for their personal or business use. And examples would include things like small wind turbines, residential solar panels, biomass, anaerobic digestion, and so on. It would include anything that qualifies under net metering. They match up with Minnesota's net metering law. We think that this will drive the use of small renewables grant because it's simple. If your project qualifies to net metering, that is 40 kilowatts or smaller, generates electricity by renewable source and is connected to the grid, you get the grant. So it's very simple. This grant would not replace any existing rebates or tax credits. It does offer uniformity. I think that it's a good incentive program. There's a lot of programs out there that help assist people once they get these things, these small energy projects going, but this is something that would incentivize people to get into it. And that's the reason that we're offering it today is again, to create an incentive for people to start pursuing these small energy projects. So we have Mr. Joe Sullivan here as well. I don't know if you want to ask questions first or have Mr. Sullivan present.
If you have testimony to present to us, Mr. Sullivan, why don't you do that? And then
sure. I'll be very brief. My name is Joe Sullivan. I'm representing Missouri River Energy Services. MRES is a municipal power agency. We serve 24 communities in greater Minnesota, as well as member communities in South and North Dakota, as well as Iowa. Representative Eakin touched on all the important points here. The one thing I did want to mention is that, you know, the purpose of this is to be very straightforward and transparent. We think that there's right now there's currently a patchwork of incentives, and in order to truly utilize those incentives, I think we need to have a broad-based, very flattened out incentive program that would for each project, it would be $2,500 towards the cost of the project, or 35% of the project cost, whichever is smaller. So really we see this as a way to bring uniformity to the current patchwork of incentives. And one last thing, that Missouri River is very strongly in support of this concept because we see it as the best way for the state to drive the development of renewables and to create incentives around renewable generation at the residential and kind of the small business level. So with that, I would be glad to answer any questions.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and perhaps testify Representative Eakin, you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Elis might share with us how this overlaps with the solar rebate program that that we funded and was fully subscribed within a matter of months. It's one of the things I think that I've been interested in figuring out a way to fund, and whether is the 2,500 or 35% cap the same mechanism. Maybe I'll just leave it open-ended. And anyone,
I'd be glad to address that,
Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin. The program would not replace the current solar rebate. It would be over in addition to that. So for somebody who's building a solar panel or wants to put one on their house, they would get the solar rebate in addition to this cogeneration rebate or whatever it ends up being called, a net metering rebate. So from my perspective, I think that's a much stronger incentive now that you've got two incentives to build one.
Mr. Sullivan, does Missouri River offer any kind of a rebate in this program currently?
Mr. Chair, Missouri River does not offer any rebates at the moment.
Would you not be able to do that under the SIF requirements if you chose to?
I'll have to take a look at that.
And follow up on that, Mr. Chair?
Mr.
Chair, Representative Eakin, maybe, as well as Mr. Sullivan, but would you be open to, I appreciate you bringing language that's almost, that's ready to rock and roll. I've been contemplating a way to go beyond the solar and where there's clear interest, but also wanting to see if a rebate program or other program could work for other technologies on a small scale. But one of the things I think we don't want to do is have investment in residential solar where the cost-effective efficiency measures haven't been done yet on that, but on that residence. Is that something you'd be willing to, do you think it would make sense to require first that, that Missouri River, if it's in the service territory, has exhausted the efficiency first before qualifying for a rebate?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin, I think that's an interesting concept. I'd have to go back to MRES and see what they think of it. I understand where you're coming from with that. I think that that's a, it sounds like a, I mean, well thought out. So, but I don't have, I haven't thought about that question.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, and Representative Kalin,
Representative Eakin.
And it sounds that your concern is to make sure that, that they're pursuing projects that are going to be efficient and that are going to be cost effective. Is that the concern that you have as far as...
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Eakin. I think generally it's just considered a best practice that we're not investing in a new generation that has a longer payback period if we haven't first done the shorter payback period for efficiency. For instance, if you haven't replaced the leaky windows, and so you're using solar thermal, for example. I know we're talking about electricity generation here, I'm bringing in thermal, but in this case, I'll go back to electricity, sorry. If you haven't replaced the 20-year-old refrigerator that's inefficient, and you're then trying to power it with a new solar panel or a micro wind turbine, it doesn't make sense to do the more expensive, lower return on investment without doing the first. And I think it would be helpful for have willing customers stepping forward wanting to do this and saying to meet your 1.5% goal, or I think that's where you're ultimately headed on the SIP goal, it would be an opportunity to go deeper on that goal.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Kalin, I think you bring out a great point, and it certainly makes sense that we should be looking at all these other potential problems as well, make sure again that we're being as efficient as possible. So I'm open to that idea. Thank you.
Representative Magnin. Mr. Chairman, I think I've heard at least Mr. Sullivan and others talk about residential in here. Is this bill dealing with residential at all? I only see it dealing with a qualifying facility, an electrical generation facility. I guess that's my confusion. Is it actually for a residential or a small business or whatever?
Mr. Chair and Representative Magnus, it would qualify for residential as well. Qualifying facility could also include residential, as I understand it.
Mr. Representative Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If it does include residential, then Representative Eakin, would it be wise for us to include geothermal also in here as one of the renewable energy sources?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Magnus. So the geothermal, it doesn't deal with the electricity, and this is tied in with the net metering law, which generates electricity, so the geothermal would be for heating purposes, but not for electricity.
Any further questions for Representative Eakin or Mr. Sullivan? Seeing none, gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair
and members.
The bill will be laid over. Representative Saylor. Representative Saylor, seeing that you have an amendment to the bill, we'll ask you to move the bill to get it before us so that we can act on your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 1626 for consideration.
And would you also like to move the amendment, then,
yes.
Representative Taylor?
Mr. Chair and members, I would like to move the H1626A2 amendment, which will get this legislation in the state that I had intended.
Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of its adoption, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Taylor, to your bill, House File 1626.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. You have heard a similar bill last week. Some of the portions of this bill were the same that were presented to this committee with regard to solar energy projects for schools. This, however, is separate. It's for public buildings. The differences are basically that it's going towards, again, a public building and as opposed to a school. I would like to go through some of the things in the amendment because based on questions from this committee when the school bill was before us, I thought that there were some very good questions regarding some of the financial aspects from both Chair Hilty, Representatives Beard and Magnus and others, and so I addressed some of those in this amendment. And so the bill says that in awarding these grants, the commissioner must determine at a minimum that the condition is sufficient to support the operation of a solar energy project. No possibility the building would close within 10 years, the cumulative energy savings in 15 years, or rather corresponding to service in 15 years if there is any, with qualifying solar thermal project, 20 years for the photovoltaic. And for the purposes of this section, the public building is described as any publicly owned building, pool, sports arena, or other facility of a county, city, or local unit of government. The solar energy is either a photovoltaic device or solar thermal, qualifying solar thermal project. And with regard to the changes on page 1 after line 18, that at least 20% of the project's funding be provided by the local governmental units, the local public building enhanced energy efficiency program, and other local government units. In awarding the grant, the commissioner has to consider reliability, cost effectiveness of solar technology, the extent to which the proposal effectively coordinates with conservation and energy efficiency programs, life cycle energy use reductions, greenhouse gas reductions, and the geographic distribution of grant recipients throughout the state. Since we have a limited amount of time, I would like to turn it over to the testifiers at this point. I have Mr. Jason Edens from Rural Renewable Energy. He will talk about the solar thermal panels and installations that he has put in so far on some public buildings. I think Mr. Bernie Eichmann from McKinsey Company needs to go first.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Bernie Eichmeyer. I'm Senior Program Manager for McKinsey Company. McKinsey is the company President Obama called a model for the nation for the work we're doing in helping our customers reduce energy consumption, lower operating costs, reduce the carbon footprint, and reduce our dependence on foreign oil. We are not a solar equipment manufacturer or a manufacturer's representative. We install and design solutions to improve facility performance that include solar options where possible. We're currently working on a number of public facilities, including City of Minneapolis, City of St. Louis Park, Edina, and most notably the City of Winona with the Sustain Winona group that includes the County of Winona, the City, the public school, the University, Winona State University, and a number of private organizations. And all of these organizations have expressed a serious interest in adding solar energy and alternative energy solutions to their building infrastructure improvements that we are currently investigating. the current state of energy cost, its impact on the operating budget, the need to replace old or inefficient equipment is an immediate concern to all of these organizations. These modernizations, these upgrades are occurring now. We're working on these solutions now. The opportunity to impact our long-term energy use in these facilities also occurs now. If we can incorporate solar solutions into hydronic solar applications, air preheating, air reheating, solar walls, solar ducts, the gambit of solar opportunity, we can reduce the cost of operating buildings now, but also the next 10 years, the next 20 years, the next 30 years. If we don't, we're going to replace the existing infrastructure in these buildings. We're going to replace that infrastructure with gas-burning equipment, oil-burning equipment that has life expectancies and uses of 25 to 40 years. The opportunity to go back and retrofit with solar energy or solar solutions is lost at that point. The opportunity to go back and retrofit is there, but at a much larger cost than if it was implemented with other energy solutions. If we could provide some incentive at this time to include solar applications, however they are defined and implemented, we can impact how jobs are planned and developed in the future, how the industry supports the development of those pieces of equipment we need, how they integrate with existing heating systems. I think the opportunity right here today is as good of opportunity as we're going to see to incorporate solar power with existing infrastructure improvements. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Eichmeier? Seeing none, Mr. Eden, if you want to proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jason Eden, and I work for a nonprofit based in northern Minnesota called the Rural Renewable Energy Alliance, and we are a solar equipment manufacturer. We're somewhat rare among the nonprofit community in that we actually do manufacture a product. We also provide a service called Solar Assistance, which is solar heat for low-income families. I would like today to take the opportunity to speak to the efficacy of solar thermal. Just by way of example, recently we did a handful of installations in the community of East Grand Forks, and the natural gas utility in that community went around and visited four of the installation sites where we did work, not because they were aware of the installations, but because they thought there was something wrong with the natural gas infrastructure at those sites. There was such substantial savings with the solar thermal installations that we had done in that community that the natural gas utility was convinced that something was actually wrong with the infrastructure in those sites. I would also like to point out that solar thermal is not a new technology. There is a general misconception among the public that solar thermal is an experimental technology. Nothing could be further from the truth. Solar air heat and solar water heat were first installed in the latter half of the 19th century. First installation took place in 1880. And on the eve of World War II, in 1941, 50% of all Floridian homes used solar heat. Today, unfortunately, it's less than 5%. Solar heat is a highly effective technology, and it's actually the most efficient of the solar technologies. There's a tremendous amount of enthusiasm and interest for solar electricity today. And that makes good sense. It's a practical, effective technology. However, it's not terribly cost competitive, particularly in the upper Midwest. However, even in the absence of subsidies, solar thermal is a cost competitive technology. There are two primary solar thermal technologies, solar air heat and solar water heat. Unfortunately, solar air heat is often excluded from legislation pertaining to solar thermal, but both technologies are viable. Solar electricity generally has efficiencies of about 15 to 20%. Solar water heat generally has efficiencies between 40 and 50%, and solar air heat has efficiencies between 50 and 60%. Solar heat is a very practical, appropriate technology for the upper Midwest. In terms of our solar resource, we often hear the misconception that solar doesn't work in Minnesota. Again, nothing could be further from the truth. We have a solar resource that's comparable to parts of Texas and the Floridian panhandle. as a viable solar resource here to make these technologies cost competitive. One of the things that's particularly relevant with solar thermal in public buildings is the fact that we can predict with great specificity what the cost per BTU is going to be over the lifespan of that system. Members of the committee, is there anyone here who can tell us with specificity what propane will cost in 5 years? Generally, the answer is no. Although we can make highly educated guesses, it's not possible to precisely determine what propane is going to cost. Therefore, if our public facilities, particularly schools and other institutions, invest in renewables and solar thermal in particular, we will know precisely what each BTU is going to cost over the life of that particular system. Furthermore, the economics of solar thermal and solar in general will improve as the carbon market comes online and improves as well. Again, I would just like to emphasize that solar thermal is a highly practical technology, especially in light of the fact that at this latitude, over 60% of all the energy we use in our buildings is for space heat. Therefore, solar heat is, again, an appropriate choice for our public institutions. Thank you for the time.
Thank you, Mr. Eden. Are there questions for Representative Saylor or her desires for Representative Galen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just really briefly, Mr. Eden's your story. The Chair has really been pushing for transformative ideas in energy and infrastructure, and I think he's right on the dot there. I just wanted to share that your East Grand Forks story reminds me of the Minnesotan Bill Morrish, who's now out of the University of Virginia, when they designed the new carpet for the World Wildlife Federation. Without any formaldehyde, they ran the test of in a traditional carpet mill, and the hydrologists at the end of the run, always checking to see how they're going to have to treat the water to send it back to the system, made them stop the run because they were convinced that their instruments had all of a sudden gone faulty because the water was becoming cleaner by the process of manufacturing this carpet, and they were returning it to the aquifer cleaner than when it came from the city, Maine. So it just really struck me about the transformative opportunity that we have here through the technology you've developed.
Representative Saylor.
Mr. Chair, I would just like to point out a couple of the handouts that you have. Because we don't have color printers, not all of you got the color map. If you have the black and white version, it's a little confusing. What I wanted to explain to you as this map shows the solar resource available in Minnesota and the United States. The colored, this portion, green, yellow, orange being good, purple being bad, or not so good. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because in Germany they have about 6,000 kilowatts of installed capacity of solar, and in Minnesota we have 1.5. If they can install that kind of solar capacity in Germany with this kind of resource, think what we can do. So I wanted to point that out to you. I also wanted to point out these structures that actually I should let Mr. Eden talk about just a little bit, just to explain what they are and where they are.
Mr. Eden?
Mr. Chair? These are just three examples of large solar thermal installations. The first one at the top is actually a manufacturing facility, and about 70% of the space heat required for that facility is provided by solar thermal. The second one is a county building where the recycling takes place, and about 10 to 15% of the winter heat is provided by that system. And the final building is a fire hall, and a large percentage of the heat for that building, I can't recall specifically what it is, but again, it's a sizable percentage.
Seeing no further discussion, Representative Saylor, thank you. Mm-hmm. And Representative Saylor, as long as you're at the table, let's take up House File 1748.
Mr. Chair and members, I would move House File 1748. This bill is an appropriation of $3 million for funds from received by Office of Energy Security from the Stimulus Recovery and Reinvestment Act. This is a bill that came to my, it came into being 2 years ago, actually, because of the fact that the need for a testing lab in Minnesota in particular, but even anywhere in northern United States, was really brought home to me by the fact that Jake Needham from Rural Renewable Energy was trying to meet the Minnesota law of having in the panels that he manufactured, having panels that met the SRCC solar rating and something certification. At any rate, he will tell his story of what the problem was with that. But we did start this bill last year, actually, and we had this was part of the energy omnibus bill. We asked for a request for proposals. We did indeed, we meaning the legislature, did receive information from two sources that had looked into the cost and feasibility of putting in a solar rating testing lab here in Minnesota. And I've had numerous conversations as well with the director of IRE, research and for the environment and energy. And he is sitting over here for any questions that you might have regarding the proposal to have this testing lab be established at the University of Minnesota Morris. So he's available for questions if anyone has any questions about that. But in the meantime, just to point out the need for this testing lab and how it's going to help businesses located here in Minnesota, I will have Mr. Jason Eden speak now.
Mr. Eden. Mr. Chair, members. My name is Jason Eden, and I work for the Rural Renewable Energy Alliance. And I really appreciate the opportunity to share our story regarding the certification process that's required by Minnesota state law. Our mission as a nonprofit is to make solar energy accessible to people of all income levels. As I'm sure most of you are aware, solar energy is an expensive technology that requires a substantial upfront cost. Therefore, it's essentially only available to the upper echelons of society. And what we're seeing is the development of a renewable divide. For those of you who are familiar with the term the digital divide, we have coined the term the renewable divide. If we truly want to make a transition towards a renewable economy, it's imperative that we create pathways and mechanisms whereby we can ensure these technologies are made available to people of all income levels. These technologies are made available to people of all income levels. So essentially, our organization is trying to circumvent the renewable divide and ensure that low-income families and communities, as well as upper-income families and communities, have access to renewable technologies. The primary way in which we're able to make solar energy accessible to people of all income levels is through our solar assistance program. We provide solar heat to low-income families on energy assistance as a means of permanently addressing family fuel poverty. Energy assistance is a very important service. However, it's the necessary band-aid on a wound in need of a tourniquet. Currently, the state of Minnesota alone is spending upwards of $80 million a year helping about 130,000 low-income families. Again, this is a very important service. However, we can address this need through using clean energy in our low-income home energy program, the LIHEAP program. And so essentially, that's what our organization is trying to do. What's the relevance of this? It's been very challenging for our organization to do this because of the state law that requires SRCC certification. When we first started our solar assistance program in 2000, we were using collectors from elsewhere in the world and other companies. Unfortunately, we realized that most of the collectors on the market were not suitable for our application, were not durable enough, were not of high enough quality, were not efficient enough. So therefore, in late 2004, we started research and development on our own collector that we could produce in Minnesota for the purpose of creating green jobs and using in our solar assistance program. In 2006, we finished the process. In late 2007, we submitted our collector design to SRCC so that we could manufacture, install, and sell these collectors in Minnesota and create revenue for our nonprofit and create jobs for Minnesota. We're still waiting. This was in late 2007, and over the course of the past 16 months, we have been told time and time again by SRCC that they are just about to complete the certification process. That was until about late 2008 when they told us that their certification facility had shut down. Now, there's a state law that mandates that we must have this certification if we're to install or sell the thermal collectors in the state of Minnesota. We're very eager to expand our manufacturing. We're very eager to expand our solar assistance program. We're very eager to create more green jobs. We can't. The SRCC certification process is anachronistic, it's lethargic, it's deceitful, and it's an impediment to our growth as a nonprofit in Minnesota. The only testing facility for SRCC for solar air heat is in Canada. So in many ways, there's a painful irony that the renewable development in the state of Minnesota is held hostage to a foreign nation. The only testing facility in North America for this technology is in Canada. Our hands are completely tied. We want to see the replication of our solar assistance program throughout the Midwest. Unfortunately, most states require SRCC certification for the use of thermal collectors in those states. Minnesota has a fantastic opportunity to capture this market. When we submitted our collector, there were only four other companies in the queue at that time. Shortly after submitting, there were 20 collectors in the queue. Now that the queue is completely at a standstill, there are 54 other collectors, other companies with collectors in the queue in Canada, and the facility is shut down. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Eden. Any questions from members? I think the committee is quite familiar with this issue, and hopefully we'll find a solution to it somewhere in this session. Thanks. Representative Breiner. Thank you for your patience. Representative Brenner.
Mr. Chair, members.
Tell us about your bill, House Bill 1737.
Yes, just for your information, there was a technical amendment to this bill this morning in the Bioscience Committee on lines 1.3, 1.6, and 1.9. The word technical is the word technology. So the institute is International Renewable Energy Technology Institute. Okay. With that, House File 1737 requests a one-time appropriation of $1.5 million for the International Renewable Energy Technology Institute, housed at Minnesota State University in Mankato. The presence of this institute in Minnesota is itself an acknowledgement of both the research and commercial capacity that our state has built over the past decade. Minnesota competed with 15 other states to earn this partnership with Sweden for the commercialization of renewable energy and energy-efficient technologies. And the BioBusiness Alliance was a partner in our applying for this, participating in this competition. So this effort is part of BioBusiness Alliance Destination 2025 vision. Some of you may have had the opportunity of attending the International Bioenergies Conference at MSU this past fall. The hundreds in attendance from both the public and private sectors evidence the enthusiasm and commitment that this project has engendered throughout the state. We have with us today Dr. John Fry, who's the retired Dean of College and Science of Engineering at Minnesota State University, Mankato. And if my calculations are correct, he was retired for about 2.5 days before accepting his current position as Director of Business and Industry Partnerships at MSU. Dr. Fry was and remains central to the vision that brought IREDE here and continues to move it forward. Dr. Fry.
Mr. Chairman and members
Dr.
of the committee.
Fry, welcome to the committee.
In March 2008, Minnesota was awarded.
You do need you to identify yourself for the record.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm John Fry. Sorry about that. In March 2008, Minnesota was awarded the Minnesota Institute for Renewable Energy Technology Institute, more commonly known as IREDI. The purpose of this is to be a nonprofit institute designed to educate the public, train new workers, and have a test center that can transform international technology to U.S. certification standards. In that Sweden is a leader in renewable energy, Sweden will be our the first partner with this institute. Also, it should be, I want to remind you all that this is a Minnesota project, and MSU Mankato was chosen only as a fiscal agent because of our strength in renewable energy and the many partners that we have across the state in many areas, including Minnesota West, University of Minnesota, University of Minnesota Morris, AURI, and also members of campuses connected with the Minnesota Center for Engineering and Manufacturing Excellence. IREDI is a project that will benefit both Sweden and the U.S., and particularly Minnesota. And Sweden wants to expand their markets. They have a lot of good technology. They want to expand their markets, and the United States and Minnesota is a good place to expand. We also can benefit from this because we have the capacity to increase our manufacturing. And I have been to several manufacturing places within the last few weeks, and I see where there is a need to increase product development. And here again, this is technology already developed and ready to come over. So what would happen here is that Sweden would get a licensure fee. The Minnesota companies would manufacture and sell, and Sweden would get an expanded market. Our companies would have robust business, and workers would be back to work. And it's also important to realize that Sweden has made significant advances in renewable energy technology over the last few years. They believe that this is big business. This technology is important in Minnesota because we estimate at least 40% of our energy goes for heat and cooling residents and commercial buildings. This is a situation that is important not only for the wood industry and the biomass industry, combustible energy industry, but also for biogas and solar, as we just heard. This is a great opportunity for Minnesota because if we don't step up to the plate, this will go elsewhere. I was just visiting with a Swedish company recently. They are in the process of forming this same partnership in Germany, where they've already formed a partnership, and they're making right now an order of 50 heating units that need to be delivered in the next couple months. Also, it is important to realize that there is opportunities not only in the heating industry, but also in the biogas industry as well. The institute would have four goals. They would be, first of all, to educate the public, train future careers, because our careers are going to be changing, and we would like to have higher paying jobs. Applied research, because applied research is really where we take the technology that is in existence in Sweden, move it to the United States, and modify it to fit our certification standards. And then, of course, the last one is testing. And the testing, of course, is a very important one, as it will engage a lot of people, and also it will be a place where companies can bring their technology forward, have it tested, and also have it work. But most important here, we are talking about renewable energy, and we're talking about jobs. And these jobs are really not more than just manufacturing jobs. They're also jobs that's going to create and connect to the biomass industry and the growers. It will also the processors, and also the processors as well as
the end users, which would be the commercial or the residential people who will benefit from having a green energy, and one that it will be important in the future because of the unknown cost of what we're having in the future. At this point, I will rest. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Dr. Fry. Could you describe for us briefly how this funding would be used if it became available, and also why this is a one-time appropriation?
It's a one-time appropriation primarily because we feel that once we get up and running, there is going to be a need that the industries that are going to be participating will benefit enough where they will be paying for the services, and that would pay for the support. The one-time funding will simply be to hire a director and to buy the equipment to for the lab, which will those are the two major items right now.
I believe I'm recalling correctly, Dr. Fry, that the university is making the space required for this available. Is that correct?
Yes. There is a space. Depending upon how the budgets shake out this year, I don't know whether that will be rent-free, though.
Are there further questions for Dr. Fry or Representative Briner? Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to understand what kind of entity this is. Is it something that Sweden is looking for a place to do it here, and that's why it's related to Sweden versus other countries? And could you explain what they're trying to do, and so what's the impetus for this, and are you underway now? Has this gotten started yet in any way?
We're not underway yet, although I wish we were, because Sweden is growing impatient with the way we do business here. What they would like to do, basically, to answer your question, Sweden has got some good technology. They're looking for markets, and they have selected Minnesota as one of their marketplaces. And what they would like to do is bring some of their technology here for manufacturing in Minnesota, but they would benefit from the licensure. We would benefit from the manufacturing and the jobs that would create in not only in manufacturing but also for the whole bioenergy business. Does that answer your question?
Any further questions? Seeing none, Representative Briner, Dr. Fry, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Yeah, well, okay. next up on the agenda, I should mention that since we are rapidly running out of time, Representative Johnson's Solar Cities Initiative presentation will be pushed back until Monday, and I think we all have to do that with Representative Westrom's bill as well. We are going to take up House File 1741, which is my bill, because we have a testifier here who has traveled from the further reaches of my district to come and talk with us, and I want to give him that opportunity. Representative Magnus, you want to take the chair since we have lost our vice chair temporarily? Thank you.
Only 14,000.
I thought that would be a good selling point. And if I could find the bill, there.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, welcome to your committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Would you wish to go ahead and move your bill, Representative Hilty?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It would be my intention, as with the other bills today, to have this laid over for possible inclusion in the stimulus finance bill. House File 1741, as members have it before us, is obviously a very brief bill. It's a one-sentence bill that would appropriate $14,000 of stimulus money to the city of Cromwell for some badly needed energy efficiency improvements. We have, pardon me, we have with us today from the city of Cromwell, Scott Warner, who is the city clerk and treasurer, and I would ask him to describe the situation that we're attempting to deal with in Cromwell.
Mr. Warner, would you state your name and proceed with your testimony?
Thank you very much. My name is Scott Warner. I'm the city clerk and treasurer for Cromwell. We're a very small city and an extremely limited budget. We do have a couple of buildings that we've looked at for energy efficiency, and we can have quite a large saving if we can replace the furnace in our community center. And we've also looked at our street lighting, and the savings we are looking at there are quite substantial as well. And that will help to make up for some of the LGA money that we're going to be losing, as well as, you know, down the road we're going to have the savings forever. So our first thing is our street lighting. We have 43 street lights, and right now there's quite a variety of different bulbs, and we want to switch them all over to 100 watt sodium, which is a very energy efficient bulb, but it costs about $75 each to do it. We're also going to eliminate a few of those lights which are in places where they're no longer needed. The annual savings after this year would be about $3,240 per year. This year we're looking at saving approximately $1,700, assuming the cost that it takes to do it. Our community center, when they built it, they used basically garage heaters, and they're very inefficient, estimated at about 60%. To put two 98% efficient furnaces in there is a little over $8,000, and there's going to be some duct work that I couldn't get a quote on at this point, but with the $14,000 we'd be able to do both projects, and the savings over time would be very significant. Just the heat alone, we expect to save a little over $3,000 a year, and possibly more if we haven't been able to look at the insulation in the ceiling of that building. If we could improve that, then the savings would be even more. So it's pretty straightforward. We don't have the budget to do the initial cost, but the savings over time would definitely be an asset to the city and the state. So,
okay.
If you have any questions for me.
Any questions from the committee members? Representative Kalin.
Just a real brief, Mr. Chair and Chair Hilty. I think that it's an important project. I know that there's been a couple of jokes made about the $14,000 and that maybe there were some zeros missing, but I think it actually does highlight the question that we'll have to tackle with OES about the energy and efficiency conservation block grants that don't go to the big cities. If the city of Cromwell got it by formula, you might get a few $100s. Or we might be able to use it as a means of expanding the lease purchase public TV, public building, tax exempt lease purchase fees to make projects that are ready to go that pay, have good payback, to have enough critical mass to go. And I hope that's one reason why we're bringing this project forward, is to answer that question.
Absolutely. Thank you, Representative Kaelin. Well, Representative Kaelin, would this project like this qualify for the federal funds?
Mr. Chair, I believe it would qualify. I think the question might be that we've been wanting to do the public building or government retrofit under the existing building program that we've had. And Mr. Elis, we needed to work at street lighting is a huge expense for our cities, especially our smaller cities. And your testimony points to the fact that it's a wise investment, and maybe we need to look at slightly expanding to make sure that street lighting is an allowed expenditure under that.
Yes, if I may, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Mr. Werner.
Our street lighting costs are currently about $6,600 a year. Our general fund budget is $114,000, if that gives you an idea of the significance.
Further questions? If not, Representative Hilty renews his motion to lay the bill over, and the bill is laid over. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Warner.
Thank you, thank you, Mr.
Representative Falk. Representative Falk, let's take House Call 588.
I would
first, and we'll have to ask you to move that bill for consideration, since you do have an amendment which we'll, I presume, act on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 588.
And, members, there is an amendment. Representative Falk, if you want to move the amendment to the bill as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move...
I believe that would be the D... Well, it's a delete all, but
it's the A09-0158 amendment.
Which obviously puts the bill in the form that you'd like to have it considered. Is there any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of its adoption, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Falk, to bill.
This is a request for proceeds from the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, otherwise known as the federal stimulus, for an appropriation to the Dawson Boyd School District. They have approved a geothermal heating system upgrade. They will be replacing their current boiler system with geothermal heat, and it will save the district $72,000 a year. And it's, I think, a very progressive thing that they're doing. They put forward this proposal with a local levy request that was ratified on the November 4th election. And we didn't really know at the time that there would be a federal stimulus package available, but in seeing this, it lines up with what that is intended to do. So we're trying to help the school district out to move some of those federal stimulus monies to the district.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative, I guess I was looking at the line 1.9 and just wondering if this is stretching it a little bit when we're removing asbestos and installing a sprinkler system, and wondering how that qualifies under energy savings.
Oh,
Representative Falk.
Mr. Chair and Representative Narnas, thank you for that. Part of it is upgrading the ventilation part and bringing some of the older school up to code. I wish I could have had Superintendent Brad Madsen here. He was down yesterday working on a fund transfer issue, but he could speak of it in more detail. The appropriation, as I remember, was $1.9 million for the geothermal system and about $350,000 roughly for the upgrading of the heating and ventilation ducting. And they have to improve this. They're looking to remove asbestos if it's there. It's an older building. I wish I had superintendents or members of the school board to testify, but they have brought this forward, and they're trying to do this in a kind of a one-shot deal, so they don't have to go back and spend additional money just to fix something that should have been fixed when they replaced the system.
Mr. Chair, I guess I can probably maybe understand the asbestos part. The sprinkler system seems to me just doesn't fit, but it's just my opinion, I guess.
I could... thank you, Mr. Chair. I could look into it more and see what upgrades they're requesting, if it's for something with the room where they're going to put the geothermal heat exchangers or something of that nature. It may be a portion of the project. I have to find out more.
Representative Falk, it would probably be a good idea to see if you could break down the parts of this proposal to focus on the things that clearly are related to energy efficiency. Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Falk, noticing it's about a $2.3 million appropriation for, did you say it was a $70-some-thousand a year saving?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, the savings would go, their current cost for heating is about $87,000 a year, and this would bring that down to about $12,000 a year. So there's about a $72,000 a year savings. Now, granted, this is significant upfront capital cost, but they have to replace their boilers, which we're forced with that as an option. What do you do? Do you continue with the same form of technology and replace and upgrade the boilers, or do you go and transition to a form of energy like geothermal, which is significantly lower cost? In addition to also doing heating, it provides cooling.
Representative Beard.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. That helps to know that if we're adding cooling to the mix as well, that's helpful to know, but it looks like about a 30-year payback, which raised my eyebrows some. But they are continuing, though, and I'm thinking of another geothermal installation I'm familiar with, but they had to maintain some sort of a furnace in addition for really cold weather. Will we have to do this as well? So apparently, if you indicated they're upgrading the heating system as well, then they're going to keep part of that.
Representative Paul.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, I do not believe that part. I was just digging through my notes, and I do have a copy of the breakdown. Unfortunately, it doesn't break it down into real details. I can read it off here. It says, new geothermal plants with cool heat conversion, $1.9 million roughly, and related health and safety costs, design contingency, $355,000, total project cost, $2.3
million.
Okay. And this is a project that is shovel-ready. They're looking at lining up contractors within the next month or so. So they're trying to see if there's a means to leverage some federal stimulus money. And granted, when this was brought to my attention, we really didn't have that process worked out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's still being worked out as we speak. So they would just like to be considered.
Okay, thanks.
Any further questions on House File 588? If not, Representative Falk, do you want to go to your next bill?
I would, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I do apologize to the community that I do not have a bill number on this, and I'd also like to offer that this is working on the one for Lincoln High School District. So if you see a letter-sized paper that says Rep. Falk in the top and request for Lincoln High, ISD number 403, that's the one I'm working off of. And additionally, there is a letter that was written to me by the superintendent just outlining some of his requests, and when he was made aware of the federal stimulus money, he wanted to see if there would be some things that he would qualify for. I went through and in consultation with him, identified five projects or five identified items which I think would be likely to receive federal stimulus money, and as a result, I've itemized those on the front. So, if you have questions, this is a request for $712,000, and it's to upgrade the windows Part B, it says added ground source well system to mechanical systems, which would reduce heating and cooling load. That's just another way of saying geothermal. Do they want to supplement theirs? So they're not doing the full system like the Dawson Board or the previous one I spoke about, but they have a plan to supplement their heating system with some geothermal. They want to improve energy efficiency of mechanical systems for motors and fans, $40,000 there. Increased insulation on the roof, $130,000. And replace ceilings and lighting on the second floor classrooms to reduce energy costs, and that's $47,000. So this is hopefully more in to the committee's liking of having a more itemized and detailed request.
Any questions on this proposal? Seeing none. Thank you, Representative Paul.
Thank you.
Representative Western, do you want to take up your...
We had
spoken about, due to time constraints, whether you would, and you graciously agreed to put this off until Monday, but I think we have time to take this up if you want to do that. Representative Western, if it works better for you to stay there, that's fine.
Doesn't matter. I can go.
Mr. Chair, I get a better vantage point to look at the committee this way. So.
We appreciate that, Representative Western. Members, this is a form of an amendment. Representative Western was anticipating offering this as an amendment to the bill on Monday, but since we do have the opportunity, we'd like to have him go ahead and present the idea today. So Mr. Representative Western.
Mr. Chair, members, what this amendment is kind of born out of a few different ideas, but it would take some of the federal stimulus dollars and make upfront grants available for specifically seabed projects in our state. I know some of the utilities, in talking to them when Representative Falk's bill was going through, had talked about maybe finding a way to use the stimulus dollars to buy down the cost of a seabed project. Buying that buys into the theory, and I'm not a total buy-in on this, but given the credence or accepting the position that a seabed project has to be more costly than a large wind project owned by an out-of-state investor, this would give a seabed project in different counties throughout the state some upfront money to bring that cost in line with what a large wind project would have. That would be the concept behind this. The other concept would have to be in a good wind area, which in working with Mr. Eloff, there's been some changes to how they recognize the map that we used to refer to as the wind map that would have certain wind zones, and generally speaking, it's about the western half of the state or western half, and then southern and southeastern Minnesota that has the better wind regimes in our state. So we would use those counties. We would try to spread those dollars around by directing the Department of Commerce to geographically allocate them. So Representative Magnus doesn't end up with everything in his county, in his backyard, and Representative Falk doesn't end up with everything in his county or his backyard.
Representative Falk, the rest of my used to like you.
Or Representative Gunther, he'd probably be somebody that would like it in his backyard. But anyways, you get my point. The idea of spreading it up throughout all of those counties, the idea would be letting one project in each county go forward that's got a good wind regime or has an interested party. The other idea would be to restrict owners from being part of more than one project. So truly we spread the ownership opportunity, which is part of the seabed concept and story that is limited to tell right now, but that would be the idea: bring the cost down, spread the opportunity, spread the generation, i.e. distributed generation, makes a lot of sense, especially with wind turbines. But it wouldn't necessarily have to be wind turbines. We have expanded seabed to more than just wind. So, Mr. Chair, that's the broad concept. Taking some suggestions from utility concerns prior committees, and the idea of seabed in its conceptual stage, and trying to marry the two up with federal stimulus dollars.
Thank you, Representative Westrom. I guess the thing that I'm wondering here, probably there would be a lot of sympathy in general for the proposal, but in terms of any immediate economic stimulus that would derive from this, do you see any way that that could happen?
Well, Mr. Chair, I as fast as they could put the towers up, it could happen. I imagine it's got a 6 to 12 month window. In some groups in my area that I've worked fairly close with or keep in contact with, the big problem is getting that PPA signed, and the fastest way to get a PPA signed is conceptually, potentially, having a project that's the same price or lower price than a large wind project. And so once that's in place, things can move pretty fast, especially with groups that have been in the MISO queue. But I understand what you're saying. There's a potential delay in some of these if they don't have reservation of certain projects or a transmission line. The other idea, Mr. Chairman, though, with these grants, I wouldn't foresee these projects being very big in terms of megawatts, in that a half million would not buy down the cost of a 100-megawatt project very, very much, albeit the size would probably make it quite competitive. But I think there's going to be a tender spot or a logical point where it might be 5-megawatt seabed projects throughout, and with the lower size of production, 5 megawatts or a lower number. And I don't know the technical numbers right now, but I know there are several lines that can absorb smaller megawatts than when you get into the 20 and 50 and 100 megawatt numbers. So by design, this probably would be targeted towards more distributed seabed projects, smaller in nature. So that should give them more nimbleness in moving forward, but I'm not sure what kind of timeline we're under to have this money out the door.
I believe that there may be some exceptions for some portions of this, but my understanding is that we're looking at 18 to 24 months maximum to try to have this money distributed and producing results.
And Mr. Chair, and Representative Junkie's bill earlier, there might be some similar parallels in this bill or amendment idea as what Representative Junkie has in bill form. So I'm happy to look over and visit about that over the next few days and next week when we try to marry up the ideas. And methane digesters, I've just had two of them put into my two larger dairy farms in my district, or Representative Falk's district, I think, might actually be where one of them technically is. But they can go pretty fast. In fact, they called me yesterday and said they've got permits and they've got stuff sitting on the shelf. Literally, if something like this would go through, or Representative Junkie's bill go through, they could be built in months, certainly within the year. Right now, they've shelved the project just because of the economic times. They are, in fact, shovel ready.
I was just wondering when you brought that up, Representative Westerma, Representative Magnus or Falk or Gunther would want one of those in their backyard. But
Sort of to that point, Mr. Chairman, I'm looking at buying another farm in another county. I got all mine in one county, but just in case there's a helmet. But to your point, Mr. Chairman, I think it was a good one, is how this moves along in the time frame that we would like to see it move along and create the jobs and so on. Last week, I did visit with some wind folks, and it's obvious that in this economic situation we're in now that folks are cutting back on their orders. So if they have 10 or 12 wind turbines ordered with a company that manufactures them, they're cutting back, you know, to 7 or 8, and we're seeing this go. And how this affects the MISO line and all of this sort of thing, I don't know that. All I can do is verify that there has been some cutbacks in this, and I would assume by that there is some room available. But how Representative Westrom's initiative here fits in, I don't know. But I just wanted to point that out, that there is some freeing up on, there should be some freeing up anyway in some of those.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments for Representative Westrom?
Mr. Chair, just a little more food for thought. My original idea in talking to Mr. Eloff was use some of these dollars for a similar type of REPI payment. We saw how fast those dollars became committed and used up. Then they discovered or discussed the idea that they want these dollars spent. So rather than give them a 5 or 10 year REPI payment by putting some of these dollars aside, we rather figured you can do a math formula and figure this. Just give them a grant up front that would equal the similar type of payment. That's where we came up with the upfront grant money instead of a REPI payment. But it'd be kind of on the same idea, trying to achieve the same thing that we saw with REPI.
Right. Thank you. Members, with that, I think we're going to wrap up today. We will make clear via email what the schedule is, but I believe at this time, tentatively, we will be pushing consideration of House File 680 back to Wednesday next week and moving some of the other bills up on the agenda. So with that, the meeting is adjourned.